It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the turn it drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you?
Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about all the news of the day. Take your phone calls. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Lots of stuff going on today, but first and foremost, it is Veterans Day, and I want to take this moment to wish everybody a happy Veterans Day and to thank all the veterans for their service to our country. And remember people like my grandfather, who served in World War II, served his country bravely and honorably. And those people need to be remembered, thanked, and most of all, taken care of. Something that we don't hear often enough about. We send people off into war. We send people off into harm's way. But when they come back, it seems to be somebody else's problem. You know, I remember as a kid, you know, growing up in the early 70s, watching the men come back from Vietnam, being dumped back into the place where I lived. And I remember thinking, is this how we treat people? People with missing arms and legs, broken minds, alcohol addictions, drug addictions, folks who honestly and truthfully were just left, were just dumped like trash into the community that I grew up in. And, you know, one of the things that I prayed for early on when this whole misadventure in the Middle East began is that we would never again do what we did to those folks, that we would never allow those folks to be dumped, people that we called heroes, dumped back into our society. And on a day like today, I think we need to remember those folks and recommit ourselves to making sure that they are cared for in the best possible way and treated as the heroes that we say they are.
I can relate. I had a brother who fought in the Great War. Well, I say the Great War, Second World War. And one thing I've noticed, I've known quite a few of them, Rick, who really saw a lot of action, who saw the horrors of war, and yet they were humble. It wasn't anything that they bragged about. In fact, the ones who saw the most usually didn't talk very much. If you want to know, and I think some of the presidents and some of those in power should sit down with some of those veterans and talk to them about what war is really about, and maybe, just maybe, we wouldn't be as reticent to send our men and women in harm's way. I noticed in the last war, there were times when the administration in power really didn't adequately take care of those people. If we're going to send men and women off to fight and die and be maimed, we have every obligation to take care of those people. You know, God bless every one of them, and I think we should never forget their sacrifice.
You know, and My grandfather never talked about it. I have no idea where he was. I have no idea what he did. Never talked a word about it. The only time I knew that he was actually in the service was when a Marine recruiter came to the house when I was in high school. And, he basically went ballistic and said, you join the service, I'll kill you myself, because of some of the things that he had seen. Mm-hmm. And, that has stuck with me. And I don't want my children to have the same image, the same view that I grew up with, which is that of seeing those people coming back maimed and broken and uncared for. And I hope that we will learn that lesson.
And if we remember, and I think we should, see, this is the day to honor the veterans. If you remember in the 80s, one of the things disgracefully Ronald Reagan did is push thousands of them out of VA hospitals, and to this day, the largest group of homeless in the country are the ex-veterans, and that shouldn't be in this country. Should never have happened.
So today, I find it interesting that the news broke, yesterday and into today, that we're not going to be honoring the deadline of July 2011, that they're kind of softening on this. And I have to be honest, I'm starting to think along the lines of Dennis Kucinich, who says, we need to have a vote on it. Right when we get into the 112th, there has to be a vote, and we're going to see where people stand on this issue. Personally, I don't think there's anything that we can do there. All of the things that I've read, we're just making things worse. We're turning big rocks into smaller rocks and not really accomplishing much except dwindling our resources, both human sacrifice and financial sacrifice. And at some point, I think you have to say enough. When will we do that is the question that I have. Will it take the 15, 16 years like it took the Russians? Will we burn through our resource? Will we burn through our human capital? I sure hope not. And it's days like today that you go, you gotta shine the spotlight on the issue and say, if you really honor these people, don't keep them there unnecessarily.
Well, the unfortunate thing is, there's some in the military who are saying, look, long term, we can't win this war militarily. We have to improve. Well, that's a good question. That's an excellent question. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that administration or the military really defined what victory is. However, if we're going to have any hope at all to improve the plight of the Afghanis, we have to, I think, put money into education, put money into projects that improve their quality of life, and over time hope for the best. If we're going to put our trust in the Afghani administration in power now, I think in the long term it's a lost cause.
Because nobody's told me exactly what victory is. I'm still waiting for that answer. Is it where they have a functional democracy like ours? That's never going to happen. Is it where they have a 7-Eleven and a McDonald's on every corner? I don't know that that's going to happen. So, what is it? And this is one of the things that Obama is going to, I truly believe he's going to take a lot of slack over, because a lot of Democrats, a lot of people on the left, kind of gave him a little leeway, saying, okay, you inherited this mess. You said you were going to, you're going to ramp it up for a little bit, and then you were going to cool it off. You got that leeway. And now we're talking about another 3 years, and then what?
Well, it wasn't the initial invasion, Rick, and you can correct me if I'm wrong. The initial invasion was to go in after Al-Qaeda. In theory, the people who were responsible for...
And get bin Laden.
Bin Laden and the leaders.
The mystery man. Where is, it's like, where's Waldo? How hard is it to find a 6'5" dialysis machine?
In a white sheet.
In a video camera. How hard is this?
In a white sheet.
And now we've got Bush on his apology, on his tour of, his defense tour. I'm going, look, it's torture right now having to listen to this nonsense. You know, okay, he wasn't against waterboarding people. I got to tell you, listening to him go back and revisit history and rewrite it, that's torture. Who's going to save us from that?
Well, I mean, it is getting bad. And then I heard some of the apologists who actually worked in his administration saying, well, that was a good thing, you know, when we invaded Iraq because we replaced a brutal dictator. Well, there's one problem. Well, there's actually two problems. One, Al-Qaeda wasn't responsible for 9/11. And once we eliminated Saddam, Al-Qaeda by the thousands, actually, it was like a magnet. They came in from all over the Middle East. And now we have what we have in Iraq also.
Well, it was
it's a mess.
It was a huge mistake. A huge mistake. And if you go back and you remember some of the bungles that went on, the administration, and I find this incredibly difficult to believe, that Bush did not know that there were at least three different religious sects in Iraq. I find it very difficult to believe that someone didn't say, excuse me, can I speak up? But then again, in that administration, where the only way you succeeded was by failing. The worse job you did, the higher title they gave you. But here, you know, you got Petraeus who's saying, well, you know, we need time. We need a gradual 4-year shift so we can get the security responsibilities to the Afghanis, and we need to do this and that. And look, this president's not going to go against the generals. This president's going to do what he does, compromise. And he is going to give them the time that they need, even if we're going to be there past the 2011 date that everybody was looking towards.
Well, I think the truth is, unless we're going to totally abandon Afghanistan even past 2014, we're going to still put large amounts of money in there.
Yeah, I don't necessarily have a problem with that. If you're winning the hearts and minds of the people, if you're building hospitals and schools and you're making the people's lives better so that they don't want to blow that stuff up and they actually want to help defend the stuff that you've put there, I don't have a problem with that. But when you're going in and you're wasting all this resource bombing stuff, we found out the Predator drone thing, not working. Big surprise. You drop bombs on people's heads and they get angry. Big surprise.
And you kill innocent people.
But that seems to be the direction the American people want to go. I mean, a lot of my friends have said, well, you know, we just need to bomb them back into the Stone Age. Hello? Have you looked at the terrain in Afghanistan? It's the Stone Age. I mean, how much further back can you bomb them? These folks have nothing to lose.
I've said it a couple of times. I don't know if you totally disagree, but I do believe this. If the 250,000 that we initially earmarked would have went in there, we would have had a much better chance. Would we have ever gotten Osama bin Laden? I don't know. We certainly wouldn't. We certainly would have. Yeah, we did. And then he was alerted by the security chief
Pakistani military. No, we outsourced getting him. We said, no, you guys go get him. We're going to make this giant turn to go from here to over to Iraq.
We also knew where he was, and we were setting a Predator drone to attack him. The only problem was 20 minutes before we attacked, he was warned by the security chief of the Pakistani military, who are supposedly on our side. So we got some real problems over there. But the point is this. I mean, thanks to George W. and his obsession with invading Iraq, where there wasn't any weapons of mass destruction. And I hate that phrase. I mean, that weapons of mass destruction, that's a big phrase that encompasses a whole swath of whatever you want it to include. But, you know, 250,000 instead of sending 250,000, we wound up sending initially 40. And we still don't have enough. If we're really serious about winning this thing militarily, we just don't have enough troops over there.
Yeah, well. It is what it is. Anyway, that's some of the things we're going to be talking about today. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break right here, right back after this. Stick around. We'll be right back.
to the Rick Smith Show.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Interfaith Worker Justice has released a guide to congregations sponsoring Red Cross blood drives, urging them to question Red Cross on treatment of its workers and its blood safety practices. Lance Rhines of OPEIU, Local 459 in Michigan, says Red Cross is not bargaining in good faith with its workers around the country, is forcing big health care cost increases on them, and is imposing harsh working conditions that may well be affecting blood safety.
The health care costs the Red Cross is imposing on workers will be a tremendous financial burden. Workers will have to pay over $6,000 just for premiums for their medical, dental, and vision coverage. We're only asking that the Red Cross treat us fairly. We believe it's going to be fair and good for workers, and it'll also be good for the Red Cross and the American public, the blood supply.
Keith Steele with AFSCME Council 31 in Peoria says Red Cross is very anti-union and tries to scare workers away from supporting the union.
We'd all signed a petition and it had our pictures on it. Management had that in their office and started crossing X's in the people's picture, the ones that got fired, as it went on to intimidate us.
Penny Shantz, AFL-CIO, international representative in Paris, says Unite Here joined this week with French workers in a solidarity action aimed at improving working conditions at Disney. Shantz says in both the U.S. and France, Disney isn't respecting its workers.
It increases their workloads. It doesn't pay adequate wages in either place, doesn't treat them fairly in either country, or provide adequate or affordable health care in the United States.
The Newport News shipyard, run by Northrop Grumman Corporation, is likely to be notified of layoffs on Friday. Jesse Russell reports.
The U.S. Navy has called on the company to cut costs. While the exact number of jobs being cut haven't been publicly revealed, a source told a Virginia newspaper it could be as high as 200 and would likely include both blue-collar and white-collar workers. Layoffs would be unusual at the shipyard, which has added more than 3,000 workers over the last decade. The last time workers faced layoffs was in 1999, when more than 400 jobs were cut. Newport News isn't the only port facing layoffs from the contractor. Nearly 1,000 jobs will be cut at shipyards along the Gulf Coast. And in 2013, 4,800 workers will be out of a job as the Avondale, Louisiana shipyard is shut down.
Michigan will save $60 million this year thanks in part to a successful early retirement program. The state offered workers an option to take early retirement in exchange for better-than-usual pension benefits. Of those eligible, nearly one-third took the offer and will retire by January 1st. Non-retiring workers will need to start paying 3% of their salaries into a retirement health care fund, although municipal unions are considering challenging that order in court. Michigan has been trying to deal with a $1.5 billion budget deficit. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody, everybody, let's get into it. Get stoned, get started, get started, get started.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our quote of the day comes from Nicholas Kristof. I'm writing in the New York Times under the article, Our Banana Republic. He writes, quote, in my reporting, I regularly travel to banana republics notorious for their inequity. In some of these plutocracies, the richest 1% of the population gobbles up 20% of the national pie. But guess what? You no longer need to travel to distant and dangerous countries to observe this inequality. We now have it right here at home. And in the aftermath of Tuesday's election, it may get worse. He continues, the richest 1% of Americans now take home almost 24% of income, up from almost 9% in 1976. And you look at what the Cat Food Commission came out with, their grand plan, the front page of the Wall Street Journal today. The grand plan is to cut defense spending by $100 billion. Over 10 years, that, I got to be honest, not much at all. Raise Social Security to 69. a massive pain for working people, raise the gas tax by 15 cents, lower the corporate tax rate, repeal the alternative minimum tax, scrap deductions for mortgages over $500,000, cut farm subsidies by $3 billion. Are you kind of noticing a theme on some of these things? That the people who actually have to work for a living are really going to get screwed? Raising the Social Security age to 69, a federal gas tax of 15 cents more, and then lowering corporate tax rates. So where's this pain? They keep talking about shared sacrifice. They keep talking about, well, you know, times are tough and Americans are willing to sacrifice and we need to tighten our belt and blah, 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 blah. But yet we want to talk about lowering the corporate tax rate. We want to talk about repealing the alternative minimum tax. I'm sorry. That doesn't sound like a good plan to me. Especially when you look at the fact that incomes in this country have now grown so unequal. 24% going to the top 1%. In just 1976, in my lifetime, it's almost tripled. They've almost tripled the amount that they get, the amount that they take. So before you come back and you say, you know, Rick, sorry, but you're going to have to work till you're 69. You know what, Jake? You're going to have to work till you're 69. You know what? We're going to raise the federal gas tax by 15% or by 15 cents, and we're going to do all this stuff. We're going to cut federal workers by 10%. We're going to cut their wages. We're going to do all this stuff. Before you come to me and you say we got to do that, I got to be honest. The sacrifice really does need to be shared. And they're talking about 10% cuts in federal workforce. Well, what does that mean? Does that mean the work doesn't get done? Or we privatize more? Washington Post had an interesting piece today. They write, former Clinton White House Chief of Staff Erskine Bowles and former Senator Alan Casey, Republican of Wyoming, called on Americans to make sacrifices to make America strong for the long haul. Federal workers would face a freeze on federal salaries, bonuses, and other compensation at non-defense agencies for 3 years, saving $15.1 billion. The Pentagon civilians would take the same hit for $5.3 billion. So there's almost $20.5 billion taken from workers. And these aren't just any workers. These are the people who provide you with services. These are people who've committed their lives to public service and to government service. And now we're talking about, well, you know what? We're going to have to chop you off at the knees. They're going to cut the federal workforce by 10% or 200,000 people. So at a time when the country is in deep need of jobs, we're going to cut 200,000 more. Put those folks on the unemployment rolls. They claim that's going to save us $13 billion. But I ask you, when you do that and you throw these folks out and you put them on the unemployment rolls, what's that going to do to that, the other side of this? They also go on to say a draft plan also says $5.4 billion can be saved in the Pentagon contracts by doubling the cuts already planned by Secretary Robert Gates, eliminating 250,000 domestic agency contractors. They claim we'll save $18.4 billion. Look, when we go after the military, the Pentagon budget, you won't find an enemy here. But again, I'm not against having a conversation about sacrifices. As long as those sacrifices, ask those at the tippy top there to sacrifice in equally painful ways. Saying, you know, wait, we're gonna lower your taxes while raising the Social Security age. We're going to lower taxes on the very wealthy while raising Social Security. To me, that just doesn't seem to be an equal sacrifice.
I haven't seen any of the proposals, and I have a particularly egregious proposal here by Paul Ryan we want to get into later. But I haven't heard any of their proposals, a common sense thing like, oh, I don't know, taking the cap off and raising it. I haven't heard one proposal. That is a common sense, logical thing to do. I haven't heard anyone proposing that. And taking, I know you would like to see that cap removed totally, but that's, you know, politically that's probably not, at this point anyway, not possible. But let's start at a common sense point.
Then why is it that I have to pay 100% of my wages, 100% of everything I earn, I have to pay into Social Security? Explain to me the thought process behind this, that I have to pay 100%, yet someone making $500,000 a year gets to pay only 21%.
I totally agree that that would be a good way to go. What I'm saying is right now, politically, it's probably not palatable. Hopefully in the future it might be, but right now it's not palatable. My point is this. They haven't proposed anything, Rick. Not anything as far as the cap.
Well, not Simpson and Bowles and the cat food
commission. I haven't heard any proposals on that.
It's about, look, as I've been saying from the very beginning, this entire scheme, this entire little commission that they've put together, this is about destroying the working class in this country and making us subservient. Simple stuff. It's about destroying the safety net. It's about taking away the floor so that none of us are safe, that none of us can retire with dignity and respect. I mean, look at the first proposals that came out. Right from the beginning, Simpson was talking about destroying Social Security. But he was saying, no, we're going to reform it so it works like it used to. You know, back when we first passed it, you know, the average age was like 55. So that's why we made the retirement age 65. So what we're going to do is we're going to fix it so it works like it used to, so that you're dead 10 years before you can collect it. And Senator Bernie Sanders, a guy who I just think is a fantastic senator, not a Democrat, not a Republican. He is an independent, but somebody that I think the majority of the country could get behind. He issued the following statement. He said the Simpson-Bowles deficit reduction plan is extremely disappointing and something that should be vigorously opposed by the American people. The huge increases in the national debt in recent years was caused by two unpaid wars, tax breaks for the wealthy, a Medicare prescription drug bill written by the pharmaceutical industry, and the Wall Street bailouts. Unlike Social Security, none of these proposals were paid for. Not only has Social Security not contributed a dime to the deficit, it has a $2.6 trillion surplus. Now, you'll remember, a little shrub was running around the country in 2005 because he had all this political capital. He was running around with his filing cabinets going, you know, I've seen them. It's all IOUs. And you got Simpson who goes, yeah, well, you know, we spent all that money. We put roads and bridges and, you know, all this other stuff. So, you know, hey, it's gone. You know, just get over it because they don't want to pay it back. They redistributed that wealth from you and me and people who paid 100% into Social Security. They're redistributing it from you and me, the people who paid 100%, to those folks who are paying 20% or 10%. And I'm not talking about, you know, hey, they're getting something I'm not. No, I'm talking about protecting what it is that people were promised. And expecting those who have the ability, and use whatever words you want, use the Tom Corbett frame if you have to contribute a little bit more. I'm okay with that. Ask them to contribute. Just as long as I don't have to worry about my grandmother, who lives on Social Security. Sanders went on to say it's reprehensible to ask working people, including many who do physically demanding labor, to work until they are 69 years of age. It is totally impractical as they compete for jobs with 25-year-olds. Many older workers will go unemployed and have virtually no income. Frankly, there will not be too much demand within the construction industry for a 69-year-old bricklayer. Despite all the right-wing rhetoric, Social Security is not going broke. According to the CBO, Social Security can pay every nickel owed to every eligible American for the next 29 years, and after that, about 80% of benefits. And then he goes on to say exactly what you said, Jake. With the richest people in this country getting richer and the middle class in decline, it is absurd that billionaires pay the same amount into Social Security as someone who earns $106,800. And that is the threshold, folks. If you make $106,800, every one of those dollars is taxed at 12.4%. 6.2 from you, 6.2 from your employer. Every dime. And now they're saying, well, you know, we should raise that a little bit. Makes no sense whatsoever, which is why we have got to fight this back. We're going to take a quick break, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
Here in my home state of Texas, we're suffering withdrawal pains. This is not caused by our addiction to alcohol or drugs, but to plain water. And to make our pain worse, it's not the people of Texas who are hooked on a destructive water habit. It's the boneheaded executives and greed-headed investors in coal-fired and nuclear-powered plants that generate electricity. And don't laugh at Texas, for the same corporate addiction might be draining the fresh water supplies where you live. Question, which uses more water? Your washing machine chugging out one load of laundry? Or the power plant that provides the few kilowatts of electricity to heat the water for that one load? No contest. The power plant uses as much as 10 times more water to make the electricity than you use to fill your machine. It doesn't have to be this way. Solar and wind alternatives use almost no water to produce electricity, an advantage that today's clean coal hucksters and nuclear speculators don't want you or your Congress critters to realize. Indeed, their lobbyists are pushing hard at both the national and state levels to get regulatory breaks and taxpayer subsidies to let these voracious giants keep mainlining our nation's water. Private interests now want to build 4 new water-sucking power plants in our state, even though Texas already produces far more electricity than it needs. Where would they get the billions of gallons of water they'd use each year? From the Colorado River, draining it and the region's highland lakes of the essential and scarce H2O that supplies millions of people in the Austin area and downstream. This is Jim Hightower saying, wherever you live, it's time for a citizen's intervention to break this costly corporate habit. For information and action tips, go to www.texasvox.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Now available wherever books
Making
are sold.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Also, you can email me there at rick@thericksmithshow.com. Our stat of the day comes from the Too Much Online blog. They write, one sign of our unequal global times, the nation with the world's highest current per capita income, Liechtenstein, has 3 times more average income than the richest country in 1970, according to a new United Nations data poll. But today's poorest nation, Zimbabwe, has 25% less income than the world's poorest country 40 years ago. And look, what you're seeing is you're seeing this neoliberal trade scheme. You're seeing the realities of it, where we were told that the globe would be lifted up. All these developing nations would get industry, and it would make their lives better. It really hasn't. And I know the right loves to say, well, you know, if we build that sweatshop factory in a place where, like Ethiopia, if they were starving to death, working them 20 hours a day, 7 days a week, working them to death in horrible, deplorable conditions is still better than letting them starve on the side of the road, which I got to be honest is kind of a twisted mentality. Instead of saying, you know, we're going to make people's lives actually better, everyone collectively better, we're just looking out for the handfuls. And as I pointed out in the last segment, you look at the redistribution of wealth in this country that have gone from working people who have lost the jobs that created the middle class, those production jobs, those manufacturing jobs, where someone who graduated from high school with a vocational education could get a family-sustaining job to where, you know what, like my grandfather, drove a truck for a living, worked as a tank mechanic for a while. Grandma got to stay home and raise the kids for a number of years before she went into the workforce. That's how things used to be. And it's interesting in this, you know, family values society that we live in now that you don't see more people saying, you know what? We're such family values people. We believe in children so much and we want people to bring children into the world that we want a parent to stay home with them. No, we don't talk about that though. You know, all we're concerned about is, you know, hey, where are we going to get our next, where are we going to be able to consume more? You look at the deficit. Finally, the T-twizzlers have seen this deficit and go, oh, the sky's falling. The sky's not falling from our deficit. I could fix our deficit problems pretty much overnight by renegotiating our trade policies. It's this neoliberal trade scheme that we've bought into. It's the Reaganomics, the Thatcherism that we bought into. That we could have the third world be our manufacturing base, and we could just be, you know, white-collar workers, shuffling paper around, service-based economy. But if you're not adding value to something, you're not creating any real wealth. You know, you can only have an economy based on, hey, come on over and cut my grass, and when you're done, I'll cut your hair for so long until everything breaks down, because eventually someone has to build the lawnmower. And someone has to have the money to buy the lawnmower. And someone has to have the money to buy the scissors. And they've got to be made somewhere. And if they're not made here, no one's adding value to that. So we can talk about all the painful spending cuts. At the end of the day, the only way we dig ourselves out of this hole is to begin producing. Taking a tree that we cut down in North Carolina and going back to turning that tree into baseball bats and furniture and toys for kids and bedroom sets and all the things that we used to do. But don't anymore. What we do is we cut down that tree, we ship it over to China. They add all the value to it. They cut it into boards, they make it into furniture, and then they ship it back here as a finished product. And as I've said for a number of years, the definition of a third world country is exporting raw materials and importing finished goods, which is what we do. So we can talk about all the spending cut. We can talk about all the deficits. At the end of the day, if we're not willing to attack the trade deficits, and a little bit later on I'm going to talk a little bit about some narrowing, but not enough, because the narrowing is because the dollar is collapsing. And when the dollar starts to collapse, it's going to be interesting to see what happens in the rest of the world. Because there are some who think we can end our debts by just dropping, doing like the Chinese would do and drop the dollar down to nothing, pay everything off. Good luck on that. But you look at this United Nations data. Zimbabwe is worse off than they were 40 years ago. And a lot of the nations that they talked about in this poll, worse off than they were 40 years ago. Why? Partially because we've thrown them off their land. Partially because we've privatized their water. Partially because we've allowed big U.S. corporations to go up and buy their land. People who lived on the land and lived close to the land are being pushed off of it. And Mexico is a perfect example of this. Now, these were farming people who were basically thrown off the land because of the trade policies. And we've talked about this for a while. We've talked about the insane trade policies that we've negotiated, where we've given away our manufacturing prowess for for a couple of cheap trinkets and really large profits for the huge multinationals.
And unfortunately, and here's where the wrath of the voter is correct, unfortunately, either they were inadequately expressed, the Democrats inadequately expressed opposition to this, or they didn't do a good job explaining our position and opposition. I just haven't seen the Democrats stand up and draw a line in the sand. Now, maybe with the makeup of this Congress, they will. Some of the things I'm hearing out of the White House so far isn't encouraging. But maybe because of the fact that the makeup is more to the left, perhaps the Democrats will say, hey, look, we're going to stand up. We're going to stand up for what we believe in. We're going to do what's right. We're going to do what's best for the country, and the voters will decide in 2012. And I personally would like to see that.
Well, my problem is that, you know, you can talk about Democrats, you can talk about Republicans. I want people who are going to stand up for me. I want people who are going to understand what my life's like, understand how it is for people like us in the working class to make ends meet. When that paycheck hasn't increased in 30 years, when wages have been stagnant, instead of wage increases, they gave us credit cards. And now you're having a hard time making ends meet. I'd like them to realize, you know, hey, things are tough. And that's part of the anger that was out there, is there is a disconnect in D.C. and in Harrisburg, where, you know, I don't think people honestly believe that the people representing them understand what it's like to live in their world. I don't really honestly and truthfully believe there is one senator in our Senate who could possibly exist under the conditions that many working people do. The insecurity, the not knowing if you're going to be able to pay the mortgage, not knowing if you're going to be able to pay the rent, not knowing if you're going to have money for food for the kids, all of that. And it's angering to me that we have an elitist class of politicians who really, honestly and truthfully, I don't believe understand what it's like to be a working class person in this country. And until we wake them up, and if we have to shake them awake, which I think the Tea Party did a little bit of, then they just got crazy. They got co-opted by the very wealthy, and it turned into a circus. When very early on I said, you know, this could be a good thing. Working people may be finally taking to the streets as they're doing around the globe. Maybe, just maybe, it's a good idea that folks start organizing. And then you started hearing them saying, well, you know, government's bad. Really? Corporations good, government's bad. Where's that coming from? It's these big multinationals who are taking these jobs overseas. The government's not doing it. Government's giving them some tax credits, which I don't agree with, but it's them fleeing for the cheap labor. It's them going for the exploitable environmental conditions. When did this concept of the benevolent corporation come about? And for me, it was the Reagan years.
No, I understand. Fascinating dynamic. It's going to be interesting to see exactly the influence of the Tea Party. Are they gonna come in this fireball, and are they gonna just flicker for a while and just kind of disappear, or are they really gonna transform the Republican Party?
No, look.
I think they'll make waves. I do think they'll make waves.
A little bit. At the end of it, it's the money that's going to talk. And until we take the corrosive effects of money out of our politic, nothing's going to change. And I go back to this Citizens United case. And you can say what you want. This was a horrible, horrible decision. It was the wrong decision. But it is where we are now. And I got to be honest, I don't know if the Republicans are going to have the courage to pass legislation to restrain the corrosive effects of money.
Therein lies the problem.
Because look, at the end of this, and as bad as this may seem, that, you know, the Republicans control everything, eventually the pendulum will swing back. Eventually, you're going to get that backlash because they're going to overreach. They are going to push too hard. They're going to push too much. And people are generally not thrilled with change.
Well, they underestimate. I think sometimes we underestimate the intelligence of the American voter. Sometimes it's justified. Sometimes it's not. I think the Republicans risk the wrath of the voters if they think the voters aren't smart enough to understand it. Look, we gave you enough power in 2010. Now, you can effectuate change. You're going to have to compromise a little bit, but you can effectuate change. And if their answer is more the same, no, 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 I do believe that in 2012 the voters will rebel against that.
And we will see. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
You know I told you once tonight that you could always speak your mind. You worked so hard to say what's right. I watched you do it all the time.
The Rick Smith Show. Where working people come to talk.
If you or a loved one has suffered a workplace injury, don't jeopardize your benefits by not fully knowing your rights. Don't be misled by those whose job it is to minimize your injury, your disability, your lifetime medical coverage, and your financial recovery. Order your free book by Calhoun Associates by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Get your copy of The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case by visiting workinjurynpa.com or calling 717-695-4722.
Is that old washer or dryer on the fritz and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything? That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again because God is a Republican.
You know what God would do? He'd cut taxes for the very wealthy. Sure he would. Put those poor beggar children in prison. Where they belong. Here's some more great news from the Republicans in D.C. According to Illinois Republican Congressman John Shimkus, global warming can't destroy humanity because floods won't kill mankind. You may remember the Illinois Republican opposed cap-and-trade legislation because God would not allow the earth to be destroyed by global warming. He even read from the Bible to prove his point. Well, here's the interesting thing. Representative Shimkus is seeking the chairmanship of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Now, you'll be delighted to know that the House Energy and Commerce Committee oversees legislation related to public health, air quality, and environmental health. They do the supply and delivery of energy and interstate and foreign commerce in general. So this is the guy that, you know, wants to be the head of of our energy policy and the environmental stuff. Doesn't believe we can possibly do it because God won't allow it. Chances are, even Republicans aren't crazy enough to vote for this guy. But I still think it's funny that he's running for this. He quoted Genesis saying, "Never again will I curse the ground because of man." even though all inclinations of his heart are evil from childhood, and never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. From the Bible. He goes on to say, I believe that that's the infallible word of God, and that's the way it's going to be for his creation. Adding, the earth will end only when God declares it. Time to be over. Man will not destroy this earth. This earth will not be destroyed by flood. I do believe that God's word is infallible, unchanging, and perfect. Just a layperson here. Just a layperson's eye. But can someone explain infallible to me? Because how can you have quotes like, I will never again destroy the living creatures as I have done, and then say that, well, God will decide if he's going to do it again. Not quite sure. But how can you have different quotes and then use the word infallible? Again, he's running against Mr. I'm so sorry, Joe Burton from Texas, Fred Upton from Michigan, and Cliff Stearns from Florida. All four of them have vowed to repeal the health care law. And since we're talking about Shimkus, remember when he compared the Iraq war to a baseball game? A game between his beloved St. Louis Cardinals and the hated Chicago Cubs. And I took a little heat over that. You know, cause, you know, there's a big difference between a game and people losing their lives in war. Wouldn't you think? Just another typical Republican hawk. Here's another story I think is very interesting in Tennessee. State Representative Curry Todd. Another one of these family values Republicans. Pro-life, loves the babies. Really loves the babies. He asked a few questions at a fiscal review committee presentation this week that made me think a bit about our baby-loving right-wingers. You know, the Christians. Tennessee has this program, kind of like Pennsylvania has. It's a cover kids. And the program managers are asked by Representative Todd if the state checks the citizenship of care recipients. And according to the Tennessee report, Todd specifically wanted to know if the program administrators demanded proof that you're here legally before you can get assistance. Now remember, these are pregnant women going to the emergency room. Mr. Todd, Mr. Pro-Life, Mr. God-fearing, baby-loving Christian, he wants these women who are going into labor, you gotta love the babies, remember, to show if they're legal residents or not. Asked if he meant children, Todd replied, not the children, I'm talking about the adults. And this Cover Kids program administrator responded by saying, look, Cover Kids doesn't provide medical coverage to pregnant women. It does offer unborn coverage. This is what she said. According to the federal government, we cannot ask for immigration documentation or verify that information because we are providing coverage to the unborn. The unborn child will be classified a U.S. citizen. Todd was also told, under the guidance that was provided to states, under the previous administration, the Bush administration, there is a technical guidance letter that states that for covering the unborn child, we are not permitted to determine citizenship because the child once born is a U.S. citizen. Well, Mr. Todd was angry and slammed down his microphone and said, well, then they can go out there like rats and multiply then, I guess. Good God-fearing, love children Christian guy, don't you think?
Don't you love it? Oh, don't you love it?
What's interesting to me is, you know, it was the Bush administration that passed this. And, you know, somehow, it's now Obama's fault. We're not going after those people. And exactly what would you have done? And this is the question I think I would have asked the guy. Tell me, let's say that this woman came in, a Hispanic woman came in, and she didn't have her papers. It doesn't matter if she's a legal resident or illegal or undocumented, whatever words you want to use. She is right now in front of you, pregnant, in need of medical care. What would you do? What would you have these folks do? Turn her to the street? And I got to tell you, I do believe that some of these folks would absolutely, absolutely turn them away.
I think you're right. I think
even if it meant
yes.
That the children would suffer. But we got to love the babies. We just love the babies. Here's a real shocker. The AP reported today that Sarah Palin was attacking President Obama for his support of abortion rights and for the federal health care overhaul, as the former quitter Alaska governor appeared in Texas with another Tea Party favorite, Governor Rick Perry. Palin described Obama as the most pro-abortion president to occupy the White House. I love that. He's the most pro-abortion president, just like he's the most liberal president, the most socialist president. He's the most istist president, because they can't think of anything else to go with ist.
Are we going over that issue again? First of all, it's legal. Second of all, for the 100th time, the bill is neutral.
But you got to remember who she was talking in front of. She was standing in front of one of these anti-abortion groups who give her money. Now remember, que sera, sera doesn't just saunter down the yellow brick road for free. There's $100,000 that changes hands. So there's a lot of money to be made in this, which is why I don't believe she's going to tease and she's going to tickle the fancy and, oh, she's just going to play it up like she's going to run in 2012. But I'm telling you right now, she ain't giving up these big paydays. Tell me she can work 4 days, give four of these stupid handwritten speeches right there on her hand and make as much as she'd make as president. Never going to happen. And what's interesting is, you know, you look at the fact that Obama went and jumped over hurdles to make sure that no federal funds would be used. You know, did backflips to appease the Bart Stupaks and the Joe Pitts of the world. And it's not good enough. It's never going to be good enough. And understand, there's nothing the Republicans want more than to destroy this health care bill. They wanted no part of it. The abortion issue is just a wedge. It's not there for, because these people actually believe in babies. Look at this idiot in Tennessee. Well, just go be like rats then. They don't care about babies. They don't, what they care, what they are, they're not pro-life. They're pro-birth. As soon as that little sucker's popped out, could care less. You're on your own, buddy. Tough luck. It's a tough world. Get used to it. You're on your own. You know, take that umbilical cord and make some bootstraps.
It is about health care. It's not about the children. I mean, think about it. If in fact, let's say they are successful and they stop, you know, the health care reform, well, what will happen? We'll revert back to the law. The law is, it's legal. Hello.
You know, but at the end of this, 32 million Americans are going to get some form of coverage in a couple of years. I'm not thrilled that it's going to take that long, but this is a major step forward. This is that step forward that in 20, 30 years, my children will look back and go, can't believe we didn't have this all along. What? They didn't have health care for everyone back when you were a kid, Dad? What? You mean when you had that asthma attack and almost ended up dead on the porch of some neighbor's house when you were delivering newspapers? You didn't have health care that was affordable for everybody? Can't believe it. Can't believe it. Yeah. Amazing, amazing. And I'm telling you, that's what's going to happen. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Stick around. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Yes, it is all about the children, even after they're born. Rick Smith.
Rick Smith Show
on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News. I'm Doug Cunningham. Interfaith Worker Justice has released a guide to congregations sponsoring Red Cross blood drives, urging them to question Red Cross on treatment of its workers and its blood safety practices. Lance Rines of OPEIU, Local 459 in Michigan, says Red Cross is not bargaining in good faith with its workers around the country, is forcing big health care cost increases on them, and is imposing harsh working conditions that may well be affecting blood safety.
The health care costs the Red Cross is imposing on workers will be a tremendous financial burden. Workers will have to pay over $6,000 in just for premiums for their medical, dental, and vision coverage. We're only asking that the Red Cross treat us fairly. We believe it's going to be fair and good for workers, and it'll also be good for the Red Cross and the American public, the blood supply.
Keith Steele with AFSCME Council 31 in Peoria says Red Cross is very anti-union and tries to scare workers away from supporting the union.
We had all signed a petition, and it had our pictures on it. Management had that in their office and started crossing X's in the people's picture, the ones that got fired, as it went on to intimidate us.
Penny Shantz, AFL-CIO International Representative in Paris, says Unite Here joined this week with French workers in a solidarity action aimed at improving working conditions at Disney. Shantz says in both the U.S. and France, Disney isn't respecting its workers.
It increases their workloads. It doesn't pay adequate wages in either place, doesn't treat them fairly in either country, or provide adequate or affordable health care in the United States.
The Newport News shipyard, run by Northrop Grumman Corporation, is likely to be notified of layoffs on Friday. Jesse Russell reports.
The U.S. Navy has called on the company to cut costs. While the exact number of jobs being cut haven't been publicly revealed, a source told a Virginia newspaper it could be as high as 200 and would likely include both blue-collar and white-collar workers. Layoffs would be unusual at the shipyard, which has added more than 3,000 workers over the last decade. The last time workers faced layoffs was in 1999, when more than 400 jobs were cut. Newport News isn't the only port facing layoffs from the contractor. Nearly 1,000 jobs will be cut at shipyards along the Gulf Coast. And in 2013, 4,800 workers will be out of a job as the Avondale, Louisiana shipyard is shut down.
Michigan will save $60 million this year thanks in part to a successful early retirement program. The state offered workers an option to take early retirement in exchange for better-than-usual pension benefits. Of those eligible, nearly one-third took the offer and will retire by January 1st. Non-retiring workers will need to start paying 3% of their salaries into a retirement health care fund, although municipal unions are considering challenging that order in court. Michigan has been trying to deal with a $1.5 billion budget deficit. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.com.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, that's what the Republicans are saying. We're going to be the sledgehammer. We're going to come in. We're going to smash the budgets. We're going to smash it all down, and we're going to slash and burn government. We're going to cut all those programs. We're going to cut taxes. We're going to cut.
You know, never mind helping people. Never mind those folks in the nursing homes who need it. Never mind Granny. Never mind those kids who need to be educated. Never mind those children who need to get to school on the bus. Never mind any of that. Never mind the police and the fire and all of that. Never mind it. Because what's sacrosanct, what's so important, is that we can continue to give massive tax handouts to the people who don't need it, at the expense of folks who really honestly and truthfully are desperate. Because we've created a desperation class in this country. And I found it interesting that the Columbus Dispatch had a story yesterday that one of their state representatives, William Batchelder, he's probably going to be the new Speaker of the House because Ohio, like Pennsylvania, had a massive Republican wave hit him. But he told the Ohio Council of Retail Merchants that he recalls working on some tough issues in the 90s, but, quote, I don't recall any of them quite like what we're going to face this session. The budget is a huge challenge, he told the lunch crowd at the Columbus Athletic Club. You know, people who are well-fed and very happy. Things are going to be tough, but not for you. Don't worry about you. You're going to be all right. He noted that one might have to go back to 1937 to find the low proportion of debt to equity and income ratio that Ohio now has, much like Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania and Ohio are in similar situations. Ohio a little worse, because they've done some really dumb things with big tax handouts. He says, I'm not sure what the answers are, but it's going to be a serious problem that will require the very best people. He's been in the House there in Ohio for 35 years. 35 years. If there's ever anyone who should suffer the anti-incumbent rage, is a guy who's been there for 35 years. But he claims he's got the smart people on his team. The smart people needed to do this. And what is he going to do with his 60-41 majority? What's he going to do with the $8 billion shortfall in the next 2 years? Well, he's going to go after Medicaid. He's going to slash the $12.5 billion state federal health insurance program for the poor and the disabled. He's going to change how it's calculated, because now it's calculated 200% above poverty. He wants to go to just the poverty level. So you're going to cut off a massive amount of working people. So good for them. 20% of Medicaid recipients are people who are in nursing homes. So, you know, here again. What? Let those people live in nursing homes with dignity? Are you kidding me? And you look at Ohio. Another one of these states gave the baby away with the bathwater. Back in 05, they passed massive tax handouts for the very wealthy. And they starved the state of valuable resources. And now the mess that they've created is helping them to destroy everything that they've been fighting against since the 30s. So I say, you know, mission accomplished. Mission accomplished. Because they were never in favor of Social Security. They were never in favor of helping the poor. They were never in favor of welfare or any of those things. So why is it surprising now that they're going to go after it and destroy it? And if you remember yesterday, we talked about Kevin McCarthy, the Republican from California who was on NewsHour. And he said, you know what? We're going to balance the budget. We've got a path. We've got the path. And he rolled out his big spending cuts, which amounted to less than one half of 1% of the budget. One half of 1%. We're gonna cut subsidies to Amtrak sleeper cars. Gonna save us $120 million. 0.003%. Gonna cut economic aid to foreign nations. 0.2%. Half of the money that they're going to save actually goes to Afghanistan, so you figure that out, because I can't. And the big one for me, again, balancing the budgets on the backs of those who are unable to stand up for themselves. He wants to cut the child nutrition programs. He says he can save $8.28 billion. Here's the problem. Of the thing he wants to cut, more than 90% of those nutrition funding things are mandatory. You can't cut it. So you're talking about even a smaller number. And what else does he want to go after? He wants to go after the fund that is the special supplemental nutrition program for women, infants, and children. You know, the WIC program. Because heaven forbid that a baby get milk and that a family have, you know, a few basic necessities. Heaven forbid. You're talking about 9 million low-income women and children. And I always go back to, what kind of society do you want to be? What kind of society do you want to be remembered as? One that handed the very wealthy more than they could ever possibly spend at the expense of women and children? Because this is what they're talking about doing. You know, during the Bush years, every year that he proposed a budget, he wanted to cut the commodity supplemental food program, which provided senior citizens with one bag of groceries per month, nutritious food like vegetables, every year. And it was a very small, like 0.003% of the budget, something minuscule. But you know what? It actually made people's lives better. Now, understand when I tell you this, because this is important. Republicans don't want government making people's lives better. They don't. Because if folks start to see, hey, you know, this program actually worked, actually did something that made my life a little easier, they're going to be more apt to say, you know what, I think government isn't as bad as the Republicans have been telling me all these years. And then they'll probably never vote for a Republican again. Because if you look at all of this rhetoric that they're throwing around, oh, we're going to come in there, we're going to balance the budget, we're going to cut, yet they can't tell you what. All they say is there's waste, fraud, and abuse. We know it's there. But they never give you anything. And when they do finally throw something up, like Tom Price of Georgia did this past week, because he was chairman of the Republican Study Committee. This must have been the same kind of a study commission, committee that George Bush was on. You know, the ones with the bongs and the beer parties and tattooing each other on the behinds. You know, the good, clean study group stuff. They proposed to axe $25 billion in emergency funding for people who lost their jobs. So they were going to get rid of the temporary assistance for needy families emergency contingency fund, which created 250,000 jobs in 37 states. They're going to cut that out. Here's the problem. It's already gone. It's been cut about a month ago. Done. Bye. Gone. Who did it? The Republicans. But all they've got to say now is, that's what we're going to go, we're going after it. Well, too late. You already did it. Costing 250,000 people their jobs. And doing what? Putting them back on unemployment. Costing the states a ton of money that they don't have. I mean, stop and think about the, you know, for every action, there's a reaction. So if you take a job away from somebody, you put them on unemployment. You're paying them anyway. But Republicans don't think that way. And I just think they're so single-minded, so focused on, I hate government, I hate the commons, I hate anything collective, that they don't care what it destroys or who it harms. There's part of me that really believes that. And we had better do something. Because come January, when they take over, especially here in the state of Pennsylvania, because the first attack is going to be the state stores. It's going to be interesting to see how this rolls out, because there are a lot of people making a lot of cash right now on both sides. You've got these big national companies pouring money into this state. The big people who own like places like 7-Eleven and places like Rite Aid and places like Walgreens or Wegmans or Giant or any of those big chains. They want to add another product to their shelves. And this state store argument is going to be, again, nothing we don't already know. The difference is the last several times they tried to do this, we weren't in the middle of the greatest economic collapse in our lifetime. And what frightens me is that there are going to be people who go, well, you know, we need the $2 billion, and they're telling us we can get $2 billion for it. We need that right now, you know, like a junkie who needs a fix. And these politicos are junkies. They need that fix because they cannot possibly even contemplate raising any taxes because they've taken the pledge, the no-tax pledge. And the $70 million that was supposed to come in to our budget from the Marcellus Shale tax that the Republicans torpedoed, where's that going to come from? That's right, you and me. Because that money's not coming into the coffers like it was supposed to. And the $300 million it was supposed to bring in next year, it ain't going to be there either. And who walks away with that money? Well, the people who are doing the drilling. Because they're already planning on paying the tax. They're just happy to keep putting it in their pocket. And happy to leaving the responsibility on our doorstep. So all the cleanup and all of the negative effects and all of the educational changes and all of the oversight and all the things that are going to go into this, you and I are paying for. You and I are paying for it. All so we can allow Tom Corbett to hold his political hoax of a pledge and not have to raise taxes. At some point, we have to have a rational discussion about taxation in this country. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. Curious, what are your thoughts? Where do we go from here? 1-888-520-RICK. Drowning in traffic lights. Save you.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Here in my home state of Texas, we're suffering withdrawal pains. This is not caused by our addiction to alcohol or drugs, but to plain water. And to make our pain worse, it's not the people of Texas who are hooked on a destructive water habit. It's the boneheaded executives and greed-headed investors in coal-fired and nuclear-powered plants that generate electricity. And don't laugh at Texas, for the same corporate addiction might be draining the fresh water supplies where you live. Question, which uses more water? Your washing machine chugging out one load of laundry? Or the power plant that provides the few kilowatts of electricity to heat the water for that one load? No contest. The power plant uses as much as 10 times more water to make the electricity than you use to fill your machine. It doesn't have to be this way. Solar and wind alternatives use almost no water to produce electricity, an advantage that today's clean coal hucksters and nuclear speculators don't want you or your Congress critters to realize. Indeed, their lobbyists are pushing hard at both the national and state levels to get regulatory breaks and taxpayer subsidies to let these voracious giants keep mainlining our nation's water. Private interests now want to build 4 new water-sucking power plants in our state, even though Texas already produces far more electricity than it needs. Where would they get the billions of gallons of water they'd use each year? From the Colorado River, draining it and the region's highland lakes of the essential and scarce H2O that supplies millions of people in the Austin area and downstream. Time for a citizen's intervention to break this costly corporate habit. For information and action tips, go to www.texasvox.org.
Written by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow. Now available wherever books are sold.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, one of the things that I've often believed that we can ally ourselves with the Tea Party is trade. I really honestly and truthfully believe that there's an issue that can draw the working class of this country together. And you see President Obama was in Seoul, Korea today, holding bilateral talks, if you will, with the South Korean president. And I got to tell you right from the start, I am against another free trade agreement. I am against another Bush-era hand away our sovereignty, open up the borders, allow the other country to dump while not allowing our products into their country. And to be honest, if you really stop and you think about it, and I've advocated for independence for quite some time, this is something I do believe the Tea Party folks can get on board with. I believe that we should be independent not only with energy, but also with our needs, our consumption needs, our food, our products. And those things that we can't or are unable to produce, those are the things we trade for. For instance, oil. We don't have an awful lot. We don't have enough oil. We need to trade for oil. So we say, okay, we'll give you some wheat. You give us some oil. That is trade. Saying here's a bunch of money because your cartel has decided how much oil you're going to produce and what the cost is, and we're going to hand you a bunch of dollars that you're going to have to come bring back here to the U.S. and buy up our businesses and buy up our property. Doesn't sound like a great deal to me. But that's how it works. And our trade policies are really screwed up. You look at what we're doing with China. We've basically opened the door and said, sure, bring that stuff in here. Yeah. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about environmental impact. Don't worry about labor impacts. None of that. And I asked, what are we trading? You know, when I was a kid, you know, I learned everything I needed to know about free trade. I traded a Nolan Ryan for a John Lowenstein. I am a dumb kid. You're 8 years old, you learn. You know, the 13-year-old kid knew a little something. You're on different levels. You're on different planes of knowledge. So when I traded my Nolan Ryan, Hall of Famer, away for a John Lowenstein who barely hit 270, I learned a valuable lesson years later that I had gotten the short end of the trade stick. And that's what's happening in this country. What we've done is we've allowed our borders to open up. We've allowed our companies to move all around the globe and bring their products here for sale. And the prices haven't come down. The profits have just gone up. The jobs haven't made those other countries better. You look at Mexico. You look at the maquiladoras on the northern border of Mexico. Is it really making those folks' lives any better? All those high-paying union wage jobs that fled this country for Mexico, did it raise up their standard of living? Absolutely not. All it did is it made everybody worse off. You want to have trade? I'm in favor of trade. Fair trade. With countries who are comparable. And for those countries that I'm sorry that are not, you have high labor tariffs. Which is why I've always been in favor of a value-added tax, where you tax at every level of value. Once you take that, you cut down that tree, you tax it. You cut it into boards, you put a tax on it. You make it into furniture, again. This way it makes our products more competitive around the globe, much like Germany does. And to be honest, the German working class is much better off than ours is. You know what's interesting about the German working class? They actually have representatives who sit on the corporate boards as part of just daily business. The only way you get a seat on a corporate board in this country is if the union had to give up massive concessions. And the only way you were going to get those massive concessions was to open the door a little bit so we could peek in. That's it. But you got the president who's saying, you know what, we want to pass this trade agreement in a couple of weeks because we seem to think that it's going to create a couple of jobs. And what's it going to create jobs in? They think that we're going to be able to export U.S. beef and some autos, which I'm scratching my head at because the South Koreans import hundreds of thousands of autos into this country. And what, you know, what the South Koreans are saying, well, you know, you guys make the replacement parts. So that's kind of even, right? You know, that alternator you guys make for our cars, that's kind of even. Nice swap, right? No, it's not. It's not at all. And to be honest, the South Koreans don't want it either. Because it's bad for them as well. Because it draws down wages. It draws down living conditions. And who benefits? Again, it goes back to the very wealthy who benefit, which is the whole point of this neoliberal model. The whole point. Interesting story today. I believe it was the Wall Street Journal who had it. The U.S. trade deficit narrows. They write the U.S. trade deficit shrank in September and the numbers of new claims for unemployment insurance fell to their lowest level in 2 years. Wait a second. Hold on. Help me here. The trade deficit shrank. Got smaller. Trade deficit smaller. Unemployment. Lowest level in 2 years. That can't be. There can be no correlation there, right?
Well, actually, there's a direct correlation.
Shh. You're not supposed to tell them that. Of course there's a direct correlation. But you know, the reality is, you know, you look at our trade deficit. It's still massive. $44 billion. So what does that mean? That means that we bought $44 billion worth of stuff from everybody else around the globe. And more than they bought from us. So that $44 billion. And this is down 5.3% from the month before. So it's gotten better, but not quick enough. So that $44 billion in trinkets and South Korean cars and basically everything from China and oil and all of this stuff that we've sent these dollars overseas, it has to come back. And where does it come back? Well, they buy up our treasury bonds. They buy up our government. They buy up our corporations. That money has to come back here. That's what happens when the dollar is the world currency. It has to come back. And we've been able to run huge deficits because we have this wonder of the dollar. But $44 billion in September. And overall sales abroad expanded to $154 billion. So we sold $154 billion abroad. But again, we imported almost $200 billion. So what I'm saying we need to start doing, we need to keep shrinking that. And for me, it comes back down to putting up some barriers, some common sense barriers. Year to date, the trade deficit stands at $379.1 billion. $380 billion. So that means $380 billion left the shores of this country because we bought things from other people that they created. You know, they cut down a tree and they created some furniture and we bought it. They got the value added money. And now that money's going to come back here and it's going to go into just what we said, buying other companies, buying our debt. But still, it is a small decrease, and hopefully as we move forward, things will continue to change. And when we come back in a minute, I want to talk about some of the products that are no longer made in this country. Because, you know, as I've always said, I prefer to buy American-made products. I look for American-made products. When I walk around at a park and I see somebody wearing an I Love America t-shirt or any of that stuff, I ask them, hey, where's that made? And more often than not, it's not made here. And I think as consumers, we need to start demanding that products are made in the U.S. and stop buying the Chinese stuff. Stop buying the foreign-made stuff. And I know, Rick, you're being an economic nationalist. Yes. On some level, yeah. Because the job that I may save, that job may be my job. That may be my neighbor's job. Because I do believe at the end of the day, we need to be independent, not only in our energy needs, but also in what we can produce. Simple stuff. When we come back, the 18 products that we used to make that we don't make anymore. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. We're right back after this.
Radio of, for, and by we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
If you're injured at work, do you think you need an attorney? You probably don't. To protect yourself, you do need to know your rights. Retain control. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com. We're calling 695-4722. Don't be taken advantage of. Order your free book, The Seven Deadly Sins That Can Destroy Your Pennsylvania Workers' Compensation Case, by visiting workinjuryinpa.com or calling 695-4722.
That old washer or dryer on the fritz, and you don't have the bucks for a new one?
Call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
You say that old refrigerator isn't refrigerating so well.
Call Mike at Klein's, 243-3211.
How about a bunch of money to replace your old stove or microwave?
Again, save the cost of a new one. Just call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Here at the radio station, we call Mike our resident mechanical and electronics genius. Have you ever met someone who can literally fix anything?
That's Mike.
Call him at 243-3211.
You'd be amazed to learn how well many of the older appliances were made. A simple repair might give you another 5, 10, or even 20 years of service from that old washer, dryer, stove, or refrigerator at a fraction of the cost of a new one. Mike repairs TVs and electronics, too.
So call Mike at Klein's Appliance Repair Service, 243-3211.
Let Mike fix it right, and you pocket the savings.
That's 243-3211 for Mike at Klein's Appliances Repair Service.
Where family values are more than slogans. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, you used to think that. You used to think Pittsburgh was steel. Same thing with Cleveland, steel. Detroit autos. You used to think Toledo, Ohio, glass. You know, the glass monument they just put up, made with all Chinese-made glass. Really? Are you kidding me? I mean, that's really, really indicative of what's happened to this country. We used to be a manufacturing powerhouse. And it's not like anybody beat us. It's not like there was a competition and someone else made a better widget or someone else produced it better or faster or smarter. It was none of that. It was, hey, I can move overseas and make more profit. And Steve Capozzola over at the Alliance for American Manufacturing came up with a 18 iconic products that America doesn't make anymore. And I want to talk a little bit about it because, you know, some of the stuff I didn't even know. Like Rawlings baseballs. Did you know that Rawlings baseballs, the baseballs that Major League Baseball uses, the official supplier of baseballs to Major League Baseball, they haven't produced baseballs in the U.S. since 1969. They're made in Costa Rica now. I mean, I thought at some level there was, hey, the uniforms, the hats, the bats, the balls, all that stuff. You know, footballs, pads, all that stuff made in the U.S. at least, but evidently not.
I knew about the baseballs. That's been a while.
Well, yeah, 1969, almost before I was born, they stopped making them here. Etch and Sketch. You remember that little 1960s toy Etch and Sketch? Used to be made in Bryan, Ohio, a little small town there, 8,000 people, made by a toy maker named Ohio Art. They moved their production where? China, year 2000. No more Etch-N-Sketches made in the U.S. Remember Converse, the Chuckies? Remember those? The canvas tennis shoes? No more. More made in the U.S. Used to be made.
Is that right?
Yep.
They moved them back, huh? Okay.
Nope. Made in Indonesia.
Wow.
They used to be, 1909, they started in Massachusetts. And gone. Goodbye. And you know what they did? They sold over half a billion pairs by 1997. They moved out of the country in 2001. In fact, when I was in school, I had two pair of Chuckies.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're made in Indonesia. Stainless steel rebar. You know, the stuff that we're supposed to be using to, help our roads and bridges. Not anymore. Not anymore. Made in a number of places overseas. And remember, we had talked about the Buy American Act, which required government mass transit spending to use American products. We can't. Because we don't make them. And this is another example of what I was talking about before. And another example in a long line of examples where our trade policies have created these massive deficits that have given countries like China large amounts of our dollars. And those dollars have to come back. So what do? They buy up, a factory that makes stainless steel rebar. They break that factory down, they crate it up, and they ship it back to China, and they recreate it exactly like it was here. The only difference is the guy who's punching out the steel, making 20, 30 cents an hour, as opposed to the guy here who was making probably 18, 20 bucks an hour with decent health benefits and a pension. And now the guy who used to have the job here is collecting unemployment, worrying that they're going to raise the retirement age to 69 because he's in his 50s and he's worried that he's not going to be able to make it to retirement age because nobody will hire him. Dress shirts. You know, we talk about dress shirts, and there are a number of places that that make dress shirts. The last major shirt factory in the U.S. Closed in October of 2002, according to the New York Times. The company was C.F. Hathaway. That Maine's factory had been producing shirts since 1837. Now they're made, you know, Guatemala, Honduras, Sri Lanka, Indonesia, India, Pakistan, you name it. They're made everywhere but here. Mattel Toys. All Mattel Toys. Gone. Their last production in this country, year 2002. The largest toy company in the world. The largest toy company in the world closed their last American factory in 2002. Their headquarters is still in California because they're an American company. But they produce 65% of their product in China. And you remember the steelworkers did a bit a couple of years ago about all of the toxic lead in these toys. Mattel got themselves in a bunch of trouble over it as well. Another one of these companies said, oh, go ahead, you know, we'll make it in China. And they, yeah, no inspections, no worries. Hey, it's all about the bottom line. It's pure capitalism. It's about money. If the consumer gets hurt, screw him. He can sue if he lives through it. Minivans. Did you realize that minivans, I guess, are no longer made in the U.S.? Also, a waiver to the Buy American Act permitted an American producer of wheelchair-accessible minivans to purchase Canadian chassis for use in government contracts because no chassis were available in the United States. The waiver specified General Motors and Chrysler minivan chassis, including those used on the Chevrolet Uplander, the Pontiac Montana, the Buick Terenza, the Saturn Relay, Chrysler Town & Country, Dodge Grand Caravan, are no longer manufactured in the United States. Note the Buy American Act requires government mass transportation to use American products. I didn't realize that. I'd like to check into that. Vending machines. Evidently, we don't make vending machines either. We don't make Levi's jeans. We haven't made jeans in the U.S. for, according to this, 2003, because Levi Strauss closed down its last factory. Now all production is done in Latin America and Asia. So, you know, and I think about blue jeans. What's more American than a pair of blue jeans? Mm-hmm. We don't make any of that stuff anymore.
I literally remember being Corvettes, and I remember that was right around the time when they were changing over, and I bought three pair, and that's the last American pair. Blue jeans is as American as apple pie.
No, I mean, but there's a bunch of stuff. We can go through Radio Flyer wagons. The one that my kids have got, it's the one of the last ones produced. Bought it in 2003. The last time they made it one here in the U.S., March of 2004. So no more Little Red Wagon made in the U.S. It's now made in China. All made in China. Most televisions. The last production date for most televisions was October of 2004. There have been a couple who have tried of the liquid crystal kind. But there are zero televisions made in the U.S., according to Business Week. Cell phones, same thing. You look at the cell phone industry, and, you know, we used to have a vibrant manufacturing base. And I remember reading the book America Went Wrong. And the guy was talking about the old rotary dial phones. And there was a factory in Chicago, Illinois, that made these rotary phones. And the owner of the company did not retool because they knew cell phones. They knew push-button phones were coming. They didn't retool. They said, heck with it. We're just going to cut it off because we can move overseas. And we could build a factory cheap. We can get money from the U.S. government. We get money from the federal government over there. And we're going to make huge profit. And all those workers lost their jobs. And again, I ask why. Why did they lose their jobs? For more profit. Do you know there's not one cell phone made in the U.S.? Not one? Not one manufactured in this country. Nothing. Dell Computers, they haven't made any computers here in the U.S. since January of this year. Canned sardines evidently are now no longer made in the U.S., which I'm trying to figure that one out. Pontiac cars, gone. No more Pontiacs. And also forks and spoons and knives. The last flatware factory in the U.S. closed this past summer. Sherrill Manufacturing bought Oneida Limited and shut down its fork and knife operations. And also, as we talked about just last month, incandescent light bulbs are no longer going to be produced in the U.S. They're actually being obsolete because of a law that was recently passed. But, you know, you look at this stuff and jobs gone, gone, gone. Let's go to the phones. We got Mike on line one. How are we doing today, Mike?
Hi, Rick. Did you notice the coverage on the mystery missile off the coast of California?
I did. They're saying it's not a missile. What do you think?
Well, some of the folks I've talked to have suggested that not only was it a missile, but it was a sub-launched Chinese missile.
No kidding.
Yep. And it was intended to say to Barack Obama, who had the day before been really sticking to the Chinese, lay off. Because if that were accurate, that would mean that they have a submarine that penetrated our SOSUS net and came close enough to the coast that had that missile been pointed at the coast, it could have hit any city on the west coast in a matter of minutes without warning.
And here again, all we're worried about fighting over, if it's true, all we're worried about doing is fighting each other.
Right. And if you remember, a few years back, they had a similar occurrence where there was a U.S. naval drill or exercise taking place. And all of a sudden, a couple of Chinese submarines surfaced that they had gone undetected. So it indicated that the Chinese have some pretty quiet submarines, probably not nuclear submarines because they're a lot noisier than just electric submarines. But if the rumors clicking around out there were true, that that in fact was a Chinese sub-launch missile that close to our coast, it puts us in extreme peril.
It absolutely does. I mean, you know, and the reality is that we've been talking about this on the program for several years. These folks are not our friends. They're not our buddies. They're hell-bent on world domination. And we're, again, not willing to, for consumption purposes, take a stand.
Not only that, it goes right in with what's going on tonight. The way the Chinese missile became hyper-accurate was that during the Clinton administration, Boeing and the Loral Corporation and others wanted to be able to use the Chinese space program for cheap satellite launches.
Yep, I remember that.
But when they went in, they found out that the teleguidance system on the Chinese missile was insufficiently precise to deliver the results they wanted. So they went into the Clinton administration, Ron Brown et al., and said, Hey, could we sell them our missile guidance technology? Just because we want to use it for these commercially launched satellites, of course. And they got approval finally to do that after a heavy campaign contribution for it. And within weeks of the time that that technology was made available, naturally all of the Chinese ICBMs had been accurized. So that's what the chase for cheaper has done to this country. You don't hear the Republicans saying anything about it either, do you?
No, in fact, you hear absolutely nothing. In fact, the only reports that I've heard or seen have been it wasn't a missile; it was an airplane, and that was it.
Yeah, it's very interesting because actually one of the news helicopters out there had some pretty good footage of it. And, hey, I'm not an expert, but looks a lot like space shots I've seen. Looks pretty much like a missile to me now, you know. But then again, the government routinely denounces anything that's in the sky that they can't explain.
Yeah, well, they don't want people to get all worked up.
No, and I, you know, like I say, I know friends out there that are in positions where they concern themselves with these things who said, we can't rule out that that's exactly what it was, that it was a submarine-launched missile from a Chinese submarine.
We're going to have to keep an eye on that, Mike. I appreciate the call, buddy.
All right.
I appreciate the information. We're going to take a look at this during the break. We're going to take a quick break right here, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back after this.
Together, we can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9. Ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage of the Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor, was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Well, you know what I'm hoping for? I'm hoping that Tom DeLay sits in jail for a very long time. The trial going on down in Austin, Texas, delays jurors heard the former U.S. House Majority Leader say in a recording that he knew in advance of a money swap that proved to be illegal. In the August 17, 2005 interview, DeLay told prosecutors that he knew that Jim Ellis, his chief of staff, and his chief political aide in Washington would exchange $190,000 of corporate money for campaign donations from the National Republican Committee. He said, quote, Jim Ellis told me what he was going to do. Prosecutors asked, before he did it? Uh-huh. DeLay answered. DeLay also told prosecutors that he made no decisions about the money swap and assumed it was legal since it had been done for years, the Austin American-Statesman reported. So, you know what, look, at the end of this, I'm in favor of making corporate money illegal across the board. But it would be nice to see the hammer get the hammer. Because at the end of this, it was illegal. And there's nothing you can do to him that would make up for the damage that was done in Texas. That illegal money that got into the system and got Republicans elected inevitably ended up allowing them to redistrict and gain control of that state for the next decade. So really, what can you do to him in the aftermath? Nothing. I'd like to see him sit behind bars for quite some time. Would it change things? Probably not. But it would make me feel a little better. Speaking of people behind bars, T.P. Muckraker came up with this story. Former Rep. Randy Duke Cunningham. Remember him? Remember the Dukester?
Yes, I do.
With the hookers and the limo rides. But that's not a bribe. Not at all. Currently in prison for charges stemming from the bribes he confessed to accepting while in office. Well, he's kind of changing his story, changing the tune a little bit. For those of you who followed his spiral into disgrace, turns out Cunningham is saying it wasn't a bribe after all. Not so much. He's saying that the guy who, this Brent Wilkes, who gave him a bunch of money, about 500 grand, helped him with his mortgage, about $1.2 million. They were just longtime friends, gifts between longtime friends. It wasn't a bribe. No. Just because, the Dukester voted to get Wilkes some defense contracts. No, just longtime friends.
Just a coincidence.
There was no quid pro quo. Just friends. Do you think that would work for you or me? No, but here's...
Just a guess, no.
But here's the thing. Now Mr. Wilkes is saying he wants to open up his case on the grounds that Cunningham is now saying that the hundreds of thousands of dollars and the money and all the stuff that ended up getting him convicted should now be thrown out because Cunningham is changing his tune. I mean, these folks, it's just amazing.
Ain't going to happen.
You can hope all you want, I guess. And it's nice to see the Bush administration, folks, there in the Bush administration sitting in the Gray Bar Hotel as guests of the state. And it's amazing to me, because I hear this from my Republican friends all the time that, they're going to start investigating Obama. They're going to throw him in jail. And for what? Give me one thing. Well, the Black Panthers. Uh-huh, Black Panthers.
I'm sorry. I've got to laugh.
I'm going, okay, what
do they even know the situation?
No, they have not a clue. when they tell me the situation, it's this major nefarious plot with this evil black guy who hates cracker babies. And look, yeah, are there some black folks out there who are going to say that? Sure. And there are some white folks out there who say that they don't like black babies. Okay, so you picked one nutcase out of the crowd, got him on videotape saying something stupid. So now that's the smoking gun. And it all comes back down to one smart aleck white guy with a cell phone going into a housing project area where the Black Panthers were on patrol, much like the what do they call them in New York, the angels, the guardian angel
guardian
folks.
Guardian angels with the red.
With the red hats. Red. Same scenario. They're standing outside this housing project building, and they've got nightsticks. Kind of dumb to have a nightstick, but that's their patrol thing. So you got this smart aleck who's going to walk up to this guy who's got probably got a chip on his shoulder anyway because he doesn't want Whitey in his neighborhood. And he probably hates Whitey too. And to be honest, when I lived in a housing project, when I lived there, I hated Whitey. So I can understand what this guy was talking about. So I've watched the video a number of times because people are like, it's right there. It's right. They intimidated the voters. Going, really? I just saw the guy walking around with a stick. Was it wrong? Yeah. Is this some big plot that, you know, Obama's given them a pass? No. Do you think Obama got on the red phone and said, hey, we gotta save my Panther buddies? But according to some of my friends, yeah. There's this, wow.
Huge disconnect.
And I'm going, like, the guy doesn't have more to do than worry about some knucklehead with a stick. You know, the Philadelphia police should have prosecuted him. Simple. But, you know, we got to turn this into the end of civilization. The Black Panthers are coming for your white women. But, you know, you got to use fear and smear. You got to scare people. You know, we didn't hear any complaints where here in the state you had people confronting folks in line while trying to vote. You hear any complaints about that? We're not throwing those folks in jail.
2004.
Ugh.
The Bush campaign. This was right around the time they tried to steal Pennsylvania. They decided that they could win Pennsylvania. They sent, by all reports, and this is inside stuff, but by all reports, about 32 operatives in the state of Pennsylvania to deliberately try to keep the vote down. There were some reports in Harrisburg, people going and knocking on doors, the elderly, and saying, by the way, the rules have changed, and you are no longer eligible to vote. Now, that might sound silly to us, but to an elderly person, a lot of people, we'd be intimidated to say, well, you know, what can I do about it? They posted signs, don't forget to vote on Wednesday, November 3rd or whatever it was.
They do that every time.
And now, that sounds silly, but to some people, if you do that enough in enough cities, and by the way, they were in high-performance Democratic, just happened to be, by a sheer coincidence, high-performance Democratic districts. And especially with the elderly, I believe with most elderly, that would probably be, you know, most of them would probably say, well, you know, I want to vote, but if I can't, I can. That kind of stuff, if you do it enough, and you have enough people working on it, it can make a difference.
You know, for folks like me, you know, and look, I would go just out of spite. I mean, I guess that's just my personality. I would show up at the voting poll just out of spite to say, I know some nitwit came to my house and said I can't vote, but I'm here, and you're going to take me away. If you're going to deny me my right, you're going to take me away.
Well, if they come off as legitimate and they're smart enough to do that, I mean, these weren't people coming in with a baseball bat saying, now look here, Ma and Pa Kettle, you can't show up or we're going to beat you up. No, I mean, they were a little sophisticated. They used a little, you know, a little of their brain power, and they did it right. The point is, it was organized by the Bush Reelection Committee.
No, I'm not saying that they didn't. I just wouldn't work on me.
Well, I'm sure it would.
Yes, but that's going to bring them down. The investigations are coming. Going to bring him down. And yet again, they can't tell me one thing that he's done. Oh, health care. Well, is that an impeachable offense? Giving people health care? Gee,
it's unconstitutional, didn't you know?
But that's why you have a Supreme Court to make that decision. And they will make that decision. Our democracy is not coming to a screeching halt. We're going to see a lot of pain and suffering, but it's not coming to a screeching halt, not just yet. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. We're right back.
Listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Workers Independent News, I'm Doug Cunningham.
Interfaith Worker Justice has released a guide to congregations sponsoring Red Cross blood drives, urging them to question Red Cross on treatment of its workers and its blood safety practices. Lance Rines of OPEIU, Local 459 in Michigan, says Red Cross is not bargaining in good faith with its workers around the country, is forcing big health care cost increases on them, and is imposing harsh working conditions that may well be affecting blood safety.
The health care costs the Red Cross is imposing on workers will be a tremendous financial burden. Workers will have to pay over $6,000 just for premiums for their medical, dental, and vision coverage. We're only asking that the Red Cross treat us fairly. We believe it's going to be fair and good for workers, and it'll also be good for the Red Cross and the American public, the blood supply.
Keith Steele with AFSCME Council 31 in Peoria says Red Cross is very anti-union and tries to scare workers away from supporting the union.
We'd all signed a petition and it had our pictures on it. Management had that in their office and started crossing X's in the people's picture, the ones that got fired, as it went on to intimidate us.
Penny Shantz, AFL-CIO International Representative in Paris, says Unite Here joined this week with French workers in a solidarity action aimed at improving working conditions at Disney. Shantz says in both the U.S. and France, Disney isn't respecting its workers.
It increases their workloads. It doesn't pay adequate wages in either place, doesn't treat them fairly in either country, or provide adequate or affordable health care in the United States.
The Newport News shipyard, run by Northrop Grumman Corporation, is likely to be notified of layoffs on Friday. Jesse Russell reports.
The U.S. Navy has called on the company to cut costs. While the exact number of jobs being cut haven't been publicly revealed, a source told a Virginia newspaper it could be as high as 200 and would likely include both blue-collar and white-collar workers. Layoffs would be unusual at the shipyard, which has added more than 3,000 workers over the last decade. The last time workers faced layoffs was in 1999, when more than 400 jobs were cut. Newport News isn't the only port facing layoffs from the contractor. Nearly 1,000 jobs will be cut at shipyards along the Gulf Coast. And in 2013, 4,800 workers will be out of a job as the Avondale, Louisiana shipyard is shut down.
Michigan will save $60 million this year thanks in part to a successful early retirement program. The state offered workers an option to take early retirement in exchange for better-than-usual pension benefits. Of those eligible, nearly one-third took the offer and will retire by January 1st. Non-retiring workers will need to start paying 3% of their salaries into a retirement health care fund, although municipal unions are considering challenging that order in court. Michigan has been trying to deal with a $1.5 billion budget deficit. This newscast was made possible in part through underwriting support from the hardworking men and women of the IBEW, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Well, you know, the Tea Party people, kind of sad, so sad. Michelle's not going to get the job. No, she withdrew her name. Oh, sorry, Michelle. Oh, well.
Yeah, but she's still going to be chairman of the Tea Party caucus, I believe.
Yeah, she's still the Tea Party caucus, but, you know, that's something that she made up. You know, again, you know, I'm president of Rick's World. You know, oh boy, thanks for, you know, participating. You know, again, you can make up your own group and you can be president and chair and secretary. If you're the only one who shows up, is it really a group? So we'll see. But she was going for a mainstream post. She wanted an actual position in the hierarchy, and they said, no, you're cute, but crazy. Sorry.
What were her numbers, by the way, Rick? You know.
What do you mean numbers?
In her race.
I think she won 55-45, was the final.
Democrats had a decent candidate run against her.
But she's in a very, very crazy neighborhood. She's in a very wealthy neighborhood. When they rigged that up, she's pretty safe. She's pretty safe no matter who she runs against. And as long as she doesn't get too crazy, which I can't imagine. Because I look at her and I go, you know, she's really done some bizarre stuff.
She's been off the wall repeatedly.
I mean, she makes Christine O'Donnell look still crazy, but not...
Now watch yourself here.
But not insane.
You're getting into another realm here. That is funny. Now we're rating how crazy these Republican women are.
And I wanted Christine O'Donnell.
At a certain level, that is just insane.
But here's the thing. You know, you look at the party, and you got to wonder what the Republicans are thinking. Greg Sargent over at the Washington Post writes, some interesting findings buried in the new Pew poll suggest Republicans and Democrats have starkly different expectations of their leaders. Republicans want their leaders to be less moderate and less compromising, while Democrats want precisely the opposite. Not this Democrat. Hell no. Anyway, he goes on to say, I'm not kidding. The poll finds that 60% of Republicans and GOP leaners want their leaders to move to a more conservative direction versus only 35% who want them to be more moderate. By contrast, only 33% of Democrats and Democratic leaners want their leaders to be more liberal versus 57% who want them to be more moderate. Personally, I think you got to stand your ground. Personally, you got to know where your ground is. So if your ground is standing on health care, pretty good idea to stand on health care. You're not going to be able to compromise. Meanwhile, he writes, a big majority of Republicans, 66%, want their leaders to stand up to Obama versus only 29% who want them to work with him. I think you know where this is all going. More gridlock, more investigation, more stall, delay, more nothing getting done. But Democrats by Congress are divided in this point, with fewer saying Obama should stand up to GOP leaders, 43%, than say he should work with them, 46%. Look, at the end of the day, and this is kind of where I lay my hat, there are some pretty big differences between folks who are ideologically bent toward the Democratic side and people who are ideologically bent to the Republican side. I can see that there are some Republican ideas that can be workable if you can make them a little pliable. You're not going to get that kind of a response from the Republicans. Boehner said it right from the beginning. No compromise. We'll work with the president if he's willing to pursue our agenda. And right there, that's a line in the sand. Because their agenda is privatized Social Security. Their agenda is to destroy health care reform. Their agenda is to take the reins off of Wall Street and let it do what it does so well, destroy the economy. Their agenda is major tax handouts to the very wealthy. Their agenda is more war. I got to tell you, at some point, don't you have to look at that and go, that's not an agenda we want to go back to. We tried it for eight years. It didn't work. Right?
Absolutely. Well, and again, and we're going over ground that we talked about right after the election. But if you're the president, what do you do? Do you just realize that you're not going to get a lot accomplished, and you position yourself so that the American people know what you stand for, in hopes that at the end of the day they will blame the Republicans for the next 2 years if nothing gets accomplished? He can get reelected. Or are you willing to compromise? Now, here's the thing. If you are willing to compromise, you cannot compromise what you stand for. You can compromise your positions to a degree, but you cannot compromise what you stand for. I hope he's not willing to do that.
Well, he's already given in on the Bush tax cuts, which they're already, Axelrod has already said, you know, well, given the political climate, we've got to continue to push that through, so the very wealthy are going to be even wealthier. If you're going to give that away, give it to the people who spend it. Give that cut to the people who need it. In fact, I said, take that money. Don't give it in tax cuts. Use it to create jobs. Build some stuff. We need some stuff. We need some really big stuff. I don't know, a rail line from California to New York. That'd be nice, wouldn't it? But, you know, according to the Republicans, they want to cut that. That's their big budget. That's their big budget slashing. $120 million for sleeper cars on Amtrak. That's a deal breaker right there.
Well, here's the thing. we don't know the inside, but what you're thinking on, is the president going to get anything out of this? Does he expect the Republicans to compromise on, something not important to the Republicans, tax breaks for the middle class?
Do you really think the Republicans are going to compromise? What gives you any indication that this Republican Party at any point is willing to compromise, given the past 2 years where they have been in stark opposition, have been steadfast against anything that Obama or the Democrats have wanted to do? What makes you think that there's anything there that they're willing to compromise on? Boehner has told you.
Well, then
we're not going to compromise unless you're willing to do our stuff.
Why would the president, if he ran on the platform, and he did in 2008, to eliminate the Bush tax cuts, if in fact behind the scenes he hasn't talked to the Republicans and been assured that he can get something out of it, why would he do it? Because to just say, I throw up my hands, is, in my mind, compromising what he said he stood for.
Well, at the end of it, what will happen if he doesn't extend the tax cuts for the very, very wealthy? The Republicans will do that kind of na-na-na-na-na thing. We're not going to let you pass the tax cuts for everybody else. That's the trick.
And that's what I thought it was. So, in essence, he does expect to get something from the Republicans.
Well, is that getting anything?
Apparently in his mind.
That's like, somebody coming and sticking you up, letting you keep your wallet, but taking all your money and your credit cards out of it.
And saying, well,
and you got something out of it.
You were lucky I didn't shoot you.
Well, no, you're lucky you got to keep your wallet. There's nothing in it of any value, but you got to keep the leather. Yeah, that souvenir imitation, real fake leather wallet you've got in your pocket, yeah. You have to keep that.
I would like to know a little bit more. Are we talking 1 or 2 years?
Again, there have been no specifics that have come out on this, but Axelrod did say that, look, and they're floating the test balloons, they're floating their trial balloons to see what the American people are going to, what the polls are going to say. And again, the polls are going to say what they're going to say, which is, we want our tax cuts. And if it means giving it to the very wealthy, well, that's what it means. But what's interesting when you start looking at the polls, an AP poll, people back Republican tax cut plans, but not the GOP campaign to repeal the president's health care overall. According to this poll that Republicans won big on Election Day, 53% say income tax cuts that will expire should be renewed for all. So 53%, according to this poll, are saying everybody should get it, even the highest people, as Republicans want. And according to the AP, this poll that they conducted just after election week, 44% would continue the cuts only for those earning $250,000 a year, which is what I would say. I say, you keep the middle class tax cuts for folks who need it, but the folks who don't, I'm sorry. It's just part of being part of society. It goes on to say when the health care law Obama signed in March, just 39% back the Republicans' effort to repeal or scale it back. And here's the interesting part for me. 58% say that they would rather make even more changes in the healthcare system or leave the measure alone. And this is what we've been saying all along, that people, I don't believe most people want it repealed. There are some things that they want tweaked. And we can most certainly do that. When Social Security came out, it wasn't a perfect plan. When Medicare came out, not a perfect plan. But over time, we've tweaked it, and it works.
Well, when they came out, what the Republicans are doing is bait and switch. When the polls came out, do you favor the health care reform? Some of the people, because it wasn't good enough, said no. Well, now they're saying, well, those same people want it repealed. Well, not necessarily. If you take the people who approve of the health care reform and the people who were not satisfied with the health care reform because it wasn't adequate enough, you have a clear majority, And the Republicans are playing a shell game, a con game with that. And how many times have you heard? If I heard him say it once, I heard him say 100 times in the last 6 months. American people are opposed to health care reform. Wrong. That is not an accurate statement.
But it's the big lie. They keep saying it over and over and over and over again, and people buy it. And they've got the megaphone. They've got the ability to push that message out there. They've got, you know, like Rick Santorum said, you know, in the 90s when we fought Clinton, we didn't have Fox News. Today, we got Fox News. They truly believe right now, since they control the message, they control a large portion of the media. The people who fund them control a large portion of the media, that they think they're going to get whatever they want passed through. And they're going to take advantage of this economic crisis. You look at what Corbett said in his press conference the other day. A lot of people have tried to privatize the state stores, but none of them had this economic crisis. None of them had this in their toolbox to say, you know what, folks, if I don't sell it, that $2 billion we could have got for hawking those state stores is going to come out of your pocket. So what do you say we hawk them now? Without the whole thought that, you know what, down the road, it's going to cost you millions and millions of dollars down the road. That isn't going to enter into it. We're a very short-sighted society. We're a very hand in front of our face society. You ask most people to think just a little bit ahead, it doesn't happen.
I mean, that'll enable, at least it'll make it easier for Tom Corbett to come through with his no-tax pledge. It's that simple. And can we count?
But what does it mean for the state?
Can we count on politicians to do the right thing? No.
No.
No, you can't. It's almost a perfect storm for those who...
Not almost.
For those who oppose privatization. I mean, a perfect storm. I mean, can it get any worse? Can it get any more... This is an ideal situation for those who have been looking at it with saliva coming out of their mouth. They just want to privatize and have wanted literally for decades to privatize the liquor
stores. Everything. They want to sell off all the state assets, not just the liquor stores. Everything. Everything that the state does, they want to find a profit in, which means that you and I are gonna continue to pay higher taxes so private corporations can fill their coffers.
And if they have enough discipline, I think they do, within their ranks. The only thing that will stop it is for Corbett to veto it, and I don't see politically how he could do that.
Not going to happen. Or unless we organize, we get together, and we put pressure on them. Because the only thing that they understand is what happened to Todd Eaches. Looking for a job here in a couple of weeks. Let's take a break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Right back after this.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME, Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make Pennsylvania happen!
We keep South Central Pennsylvania wired. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, right here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And for 93 years, we have proudly provided our contractors and their customers with the highest skilled and best educated electricians in the industry. Whether it's wiring a light socket in a Habitat for Humanity's home or replacing a vital component on a nuclear reactor, our professional electricians do the job right the first time. Our members are the backbone of our community and our nation, working to make tomorrow a brighter day. If you want to join us, or if you need an electrician for your industrial or commercial project, call us at 717 232 7093 or visit our website at www.ibewlocal143.org. We are the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 143, and we keep South Central Pennsylvania wired.
With pride, always by your side.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
One 888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. That's the number. On Tuesday, Think Progress reported that Representative-elect Alan West, Republican from Florida and a T-Twizzler favorite, had hired Joyce Kaufman. Joyce Kaufman is a right-wing talk show host down in Florida. He hired her to be his congressional chief of staff. And the first thing that popped in my head is exactly what does she know about running a congressional office? She knows spin. She knows manipulation. She knows messaging. Well, might be not a bad chief of staff, I guess, where truth doesn't matter and accuracy doesn't really matter. It's all about, telling the big lie often enough. So, you know what? Maybe not a bad choice, if you think about it. But it kind of tells you about what this guy's thought process is. His first major decision. Some are saying a bad one. And if you look at Ms. Kaufman, she's had a long history of being someone who, hey, look at me. Let's see how crazy I can be. Let's see what kind of offensive stuff I can say. Let's see how I can inflame people's emotions and how I can rile folks up. Think Progress asked the folks who run the congressional offices what they thought of her. And they said, the fact that she's going to continue doing work for the radio station could be potentially problematic, their words. There may be potential confidentiality issues, who knows, because she's going to have a dual role. Because she's not going to want to give up her star, but she does want to stay close to the rising star, because it's going to make her a little bit better. But she's decided now that, I'm not going to participate in an electronic lynching. Which is interesting because Representative West is a black guy. So it's an interesting choice of words that she would use, I think. Again, that mentality of inflaming and being offensive. So, West said, we're not going to, with deep regret, that this congressional office and the people of the Congressional District 22 will not have Joyce Kaufman as my chief of staff. However, he said he'll rely on her for counsel. And I'm going, really, is this you want a talk show host as your counsel? Does that make a lot of sense to you? It doesn't make much sense to me.
I don't know how you can really separate the two and do the both without clearly going over the line of conflict of interest there.
But I guess for me, it's kind of now, it's now a circus. You look at down in Brazil, an actual clown was elected to their Congress. Maybe we should be doing the same thing, because this kind of circus antics, this kind of ridiculous posturing, to me, just makes no sense. And I hope the people in that district wake up and go, gee, I think we voted for the wrong guy.
Doesn't part of you, Rick, and I thought about this, maybe what we're going through in this country right now with some of these extreme candidates, perhaps this is a phase. Maybe America needs to see what you get. The old adage of watch what you hope for.
Well, we've always had some crazy characters.
Yeah, but there's so many this time, right? Large numbers. And I'm talking about people that are really on the fringe that 10 years ago we would have laughed at and wouldn't have had any serious consideration by anybody in either party. And now they're not only running, they're winning. And maybe the American people need to see what they've asked for. And perhaps, if things get worse, maybe it'll dawn on them. You know, maybe we need people that can lead.
Or maybe you just have people who completely drop out and it gets worse. I don't want to go down a whole,
I hope not.
A whole depressed way, but you know, the House of Representatives was meant to be the people's house. That's where the raw passion was supposed to be played out. That's where all the craziness was supposed to happen. So maybe we're just living the founder's dream. That you're going to have a house of really nutty ideas. And the more nutty ideas you got, maybe you start to, you know, who knows? Maybe you make something out of it. And maybe once it gets to the adults in the Senate, even though there's some crazy ones over there, maybe you get something reasonable out of it. At the end of it, for me, it's not about Democrat or Republican. It's about who's going to stand up and fight for the working people of this country. And I'm just not seeing it from either party, really. I mean, Obama's done a little bit. The steel workers have done a lot to push him in the direction of cracking down on China. And as, you know, Mike, the caller, said earlier, you know, he thinks it was a missile from the Chinese. And I don't know. Maybe I don't doubt anything, but I don't think so. But if it were, that's a clear message to somebody to say, hey, lay off the rhetoric. Because we have got to crack down on China. Absolutely, we have to. Because we can't continue down this path. We can't continue to give our manufacturing base away. And I know I've said this a number of times tonight, but it's true. If you don't produce anything, if you're not making anything of value, and all you have is a service-based economy where, you know, hey, you know, we'll swap services, it's not going to work. Pure and simple, because you can only have so many people doing service-based things. And it's definitely not going to create middle-class existences.
Well, there are some people who say, well, Rick, why do you want to do that? You're going to force the Chinese to call in our debt. Well, if they wanted to call in our debt, they would have. And I don't think they're there yet. I'm not saying sometime in the future, you probably agree with it. There might be some time in the future where they can afford to call in our debt. I don't think the time is here yet. But what do you do? Say, well, you're buying our debt, therefore we're not gonna say anything to you when you violate international recognized law? I mean, at some point you gotta draw the line in the sand and say no more. The problem is I don't see enough people in government willing to do that. Why? Because the multinationals don't anger the Chinese government because they can make it harder on us to make huge profits. Or am I wrong on that?
No, you're not wrong at all. And this is what's happened. And we just don't seem to be putting it together. You know, all those factory jobs that I remember as a kid in Cleveland. You know, the Ford plant was there, the Chevy plant was there. There were all of the little mill shops that were sprung up around that fed those industries. Mm-hmm. There were tons of factories there. The steel mills down in the flats, the steel mills in Pittsburgh, we produced a lot of stuff. And over the years, what's happened with our trade agreements, we've told American companies that you can go chase cheap labor. You can chase environmental lax regulations. You can chase this stuff. And we're not going to punish you for it. Look, at the end of the day, this is still our country. And we can dictate who sells products in our market and who does not, and the conditions under which they will sell that. Look, I'm as pro-business as the next guy as long as it's reasonable. I'm not willing to give the baby away with the bathwater. Look, if you want to sell in our market, you want to have a corporation in this country, you've got to meet a couple of things. And one of them is that you've got to benefit this country. In some way, by creating jobs or paying your fair share of taxes, or both.
What you're saying is, we're not anti-capitalist. We want capitalism to work for all, which there's no reason why it can't. When we were at our peak economic strength in the 50s and 60s, the capitalists, the corporations were making huge profits, but yet the standard of living kept rising and rising and rising. Everyone benefited. The wealth was spread out. We want, to the degree that's possible, to go back toward towards that goal. Can we ever go back there realistically? Maybe not.
Well, I got to be honest. I thought this economic collapse, had it gotten worse, could have gotten us back to that point where we could have had a compression, much like the Great Compression after the Depression, where we decided that we didn't want to have a wealth class so large and so powerful, that we wanted to put the vast majority of wealth in the hands of the middle. And we made a tax code that said, you know what, we're going to ask those with a lot of wealth to contribute more to society. And did they pay the 92% tax rate? No. They invested their money in communities, and they got to write it off. So they got to decide what they did with their money. But you know what they did? They didn't hoard it, and they didn't ship it overseas. They invested it in our local community. So when I hear people say, well, you know, they didn't pay that 92% rate anyway. No, they didn't. And I'll be the first to admit they didn't. The rich found loopholes. And what did they do with it? They built universities.
The truth is, there probably weren't the opportunities overseas either at that time. But I understand what you're saying. It was a different time. And the tax codes were different. Billions and billions and billions of dollars that to this day, 50 and 100 years later, are still benefiting society.
Oh, they couldn't take the money overseas easily because of the Bretton Woods Accord.
Well, and all kinds of things.
There were borders to capital.
You had to some degree later on antitrust laws, which helped a little bit, but
no, you had absolute borders to capital. You couldn't have hot money running around the globe. You couldn't do like happened to Argentina after 9/11, where all of the hot money just pulled out and the country collapsed because. As a globe, we thought, you know what, if you're going to invest in a country, the money should stay there. It was only until the 80s that we started seeing this hot money running all over the place. Because we broke down the barriers to capital. We broke down the borders. You know, NAFTA was not so much a trade agreement of goods as it was services. The financial industry to get money flowing across the borders. That's what it was. That's what the big money was about. All the other stuff was just, you know, screw those working people. We want to make billions and billions.
Well, to show you how insidious this has been, I mean, you talked about Cleveland. Cleveland was pretty much a lot like close to Pittsburgh. Is that a fair statement? Maybe not quite as big when you talk about steel, but one of the biggest steel producers in the nation when you grew up. Now, I grew up in this area. We had Bethlehem Steel. We had the Lebanon Steel Foundry. But just as you said, we had all kinds of smaller industries, smaller shops, big companies that stayed. And you look around now, and that was only 40 years ago. You look around, and almost to a company, they're gone. Well, my point is this. Where I grew up was kind of small and medium town USA. And yes, we live in Pennsylvania, but I didn't grow up in Pittsburgh. I didn't grow up in Philly. I didn't even grow up in Harrisburg. My point is that where I grew up was a lot like Middle America. And this is happening all over Middle America.
What's happened?
This isn't just about Cleveland.
It's
just about Pittsburgh. It's happened in Middle America, all over America.
You know, all the industry jobs that have left, they're gone. And like we talked about a couple segments ago, about the products that we used to make here, all gone. And what's it going to take to get that back? It's going to take smart leadership. And I'm telling you, I don't think the Republicans have got it. Let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. We're right back after this. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Stick around.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Here in my home state of Texas, we're suffering withdrawal pains. This is not caused by our addiction to alcohol or drugs, but to plain water. And to make our pain worse, it's not the people of Texas who are hooked on a destructive water habit. It's the boneheaded executives and greed-headed investors in coal-fired and nuclear-powered plants that generate electricity. And don't laugh at Texas, for the same corporate addiction might be draining the fresh water supplies where you live. Question, which uses more water? Your washing machine chugging out one load of laundry? Or the power plant that provides the few kilowatts of electricity to heat the water for that one load? No contest. The power plant uses as much as 10 times more water to make the electricity than you use to fill your machine. It doesn't have to be this way. Solar and wind alternatives use almost no water to produce electricity, an advantage that today's clean coal hucksters and nuclear speculators don't want you or your Congress critters to realize. Indeed, their lobbyists are pushing hard at both the national and state levels to get regulatory breaks and taxpayer subsidies to let these voracious giants keep mainlining our nation's water. Private interests now want to build 4 new water-sucking power plants in our state, even though Texas already produces far more electricity than it needs. Where would they get the billions of gallons of water they'd use each year? From the Colorado River, draining it and the region's highland lakes of the essential and scarce H2O that supplies millions of people in the Austin area and downstream. This is Jim Hightower saying, wherever you live, it's time for a citizen's intervention to break this costly corporate habit. For information and action tips, go to www.texasvox.org.
Today's commentary is underwritten by Wiley & Sons, publisher of Hightower's new book titled, Swim Against the Current, Even a Dead Fish Can Go with the Flow, now available wherever books are sold.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
I got an email during the break that I just thought was hysterical. One of the end is coming. Obama's going down. And I wanted to read a little bit of it because I think it's pretty funny. Chief Justice John Roberts, the U.S. Supreme Court, according to sources who watch the inner workings of the federal government, a smackdown of Barack Obama by the U.S. Supreme Court may be inevitable. Ever since Obama assumed the office of president, critics have hammered him on a number of constitutional issues. Critics have complained that much, if not all, of Obama's major initiatives run headlong onto constitutional roadblocks on the power of the federal government. You know, never mind anything that Bush did. But giving health care to people? Oh, no, can't do that. The email goes on, Obama certainly did not help himself in the eyes of the court when he used the venue of the State of the Union address earlier this year to publicly flog the court over its ruling that the First Amendment grants the right to various organizations to run political ads during the time of an election. You mean corporations, not various organizations, corporations. The tongue lashing clearly did not sit well with the court, as demonstrated by Justice Samuel Alito, who publicly shook his head and stated under his breath, "That's not true." When Obama told a flat-out lie concerning the court's ruling, Citizens United was judicial activism, pure, simple. As it turns out, this was a watershed moment in the relationship between the executive and the judicial branch of the federal government. Obama publicly declared war on the court, even as he blatantly continued to propose legislation that flies in the face of every known constitutional principle upon which the nation has stood for over 200 years. Obama has even identified Chief Justice John Roberts as enemy number one. That is, apart from Fox News and Rush Limbaugh, Beck, Hannity, and so on. Really? Did you get that? Did you hear that declaration of war? Because I missed it.
I missed it.
I missed the memo on that one.
Must have been asleep at the switch.
Yeah, like now.
Something like that.
And it's no accident that the one swing vote on the court, Justice Anthony Kennedy stated that he has no intentions of retiring until Obama is gone. Apparently, the court has had enough. The Roberts Court has signaled, in a very subtle manner, of course, that it intends to address the issues about which Obama critics have been screaming to high heaven. A ruling against Obama on any one of these important issues could potentially cripple the administration. Such a thing would be long overdue. So here are the crimes. First, there's Obamacare, which violates the constitutional principle barring the federal government from forcing the citizens to purchase something. I don't know. Does it say that in there explicitly?
I don't think so.
No. The Constitution limits federal government, not state governments, from such things. And further, not everyone has to drive, because they use the driving excuse. Thus, citizens could opt to not purchase a car. In the Obamacare world, however, no citizen can opt out. You must have health insurance. Like, that's a bad thing. Second, sources state that Roberts Court has quietly accepted information concerning discrepancies in Obama's history that raise serious questions about his eligibility of office. You know where we're going here, right? Here we go. Here it comes. Get ready for it. The charges go far beyond simply his birth certificate. The issue involves possible fraudulent use of a Social Security number in Connecticut while Obama was in high school in Hawaii. That's only the tip of the iceberg, I tell you. Third, several cases involving possible criminal activity, conflicts of interest, and pay-for-play cronyism, you mean like they had during the Bush years, could possibly land many administration officials, if not Obama himself, in hot water with the court. Frankly, in the years this writer has observed politics, nothing comes close to comparing the rampant corruption of this administration, not even the Nixon years. Nixon and Watergate, the conspirators look like choir boys compared to the jokers that populate this administration. Really? I don't know where this guy's been. And again, he doesn't put what his name is, so you have no idea what he's saying because nobody ever signs these bizarre emails. But where has he been for the last 8 years? I just talked about two guys who were in jail for their crimes during the Bush years. I don't know anybody yet who's been arrested during the Obama years. They've been fairly transparent. There have been some things I'm not thrilled with, but they have been fairly transparent. The whole health care thing was fairly transparent, which in my estimation is probably the reason that so many people were against it, because most people don't know how legislation's made. So putting that front and center was probably not a great idea.
You are correct. You are correct.
But he goes on to say, in addition, the courts will eventually be forced to rule on the dreadful decision of the Obama Department of Justice suing the state of Arizona. That, too, could send the Obama doctrine of open borders to an early grave, given that the administration refuses to enforce federal law on illegal aliens. And finally, here it comes, the biggie, the big one that could potentially send the entire House of Cards tumbling in a free fall as the last revelation concerning the Obama holder, Department of Justice, and its refusal to pursue the new Black Panther Party. The group was caught on tape committing felonies, I tell you, by attempting to intimidate Caucasian voters into staying away from the polls. A whistleblower who resigned from the DOJ is now charging Holder with deliberate refusal to pursue the case against blacks. I think we talked about this already. It was dumb, but I don't know if it was worthy of the Department of Justice wasting valuable resources, lots of money on.
No, not at all.
But that's it. That's the House of Cards. It's going to come down. The Obama man is going to be locked up, and we're going to throw the key away. Because I sent the guy back an email, and I said, hey, you know, if you can find the guy who actually wrote this, I'd love to talk to him. Because I would. I would love to talk to some of these people who write this stuff. Because it's so reactionary, so far-flung, that, you know, you just kind of shake your head and go, where does this stuff come from? It's like during the Clinton years, and you got to give the Republicans credit. You got to give the far right credit. They are very creative. Vince Foster shot himself in the back of the head at an angle that no one could have ever done, but he did it. They were so mad at Ron Brown, they shot him in the head twice before they flew him into a mountain. You know, Clinton was on the plane, shot him twice, you know, set the coordinates for mountainside. Or so they say. I mean, I got to be honest. All the things that Clinton was supposed to have done, we really got our $200,000 worth out of him. Because I don't think the guy ever slept. All the things that he was accused of.
And Hillary. You notice, though, she's now Secretary of Defense, so I guess...
Secretary of State.
Secretary of State, I'm sorry. So I guess those charges, which were pretty serious, at least the right ringers, the charges that were leveling against her, none of them ever stuck.
They weren't supposed to stick. It was never about sticking. It was about distraction. And what's important to understand is we're going to go through this again. We're going to go through a series of investigations. We're going to go through a series of distractions. And all it's meant to do is to soil this guy so that we hold off for 2 years so that maybe they can gain a couple of seats in the Senate, take control of the Senate, and hopefully they, from their perspective, hold on to the House and then get someone in the White House so that they have complete control, like they have here in the state of Pennsylvania. The only problem is I don't think they're going to wait long enough. I think they're going to want to run with their bizarre ideas. And people will wake up and say, you know what? Kind of scary stuff. Anyway, let's take a quick break right here. We're right back to wrap this up.
The 19th century saw regular work weeks of 70 hours or more. Many attempts were made to get legislatures across the country to pass maximum hour laws limiting the number of hours an employee could be compelled to labor. The first union victory in capping work hours was won by the building trades in 1840. They won a 60-hour week. In 1874, the state of Massachusetts became the first to pass a law mandating a maximum hours for women. Other states followed as union activists around the country fought to pass laws to protect workers. Their work stalled in 1905 when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled the New York Bake Shop Act unconstitutional, citing a sacred bond between master and employee and the liberty of contract. With this decision, the Lochner era, named after bakery owner Joseph Lochner, who had been cited, tried, and convicted of working employees beyond the 60-hour limit, began. This single decision opened the floodgates, allowing attacks on child labor laws, minimum wage laws, as well as maximum hour laws by corporate and anti-union interests. Only after President Franklin Delano Roosevelt threatened to enlarge the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 13 did the court do an about-face with regard to liberty of contract and what has been called a switch in time to save 9, ruling in West Coast Hotel versus Parrish that Elsie Parrish was indeed entitled to the state of Washington's minimum wage, regardless of what conditions she agreed to, marking the end of the Lochner era. FDR's New Deal policies helped workers reclaim lost ground in their fight for the American dream. The proposal and passage Fair Labor Standards Act, federally restricting weekly hours, mandating overtime pay, setting a minimum wage, and restricting the exploitive use of child labor was an essential step forward for workers, families, and communities. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center of IUP. For more information, visit www.therickSmithShow.com.
Making the blue blood
C Red. The Rick Smith Show.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. Also, you can find us on Facebook. You can see my page, Rick Smith, or the Rick Smith Show Facebook page. We do enjoy the interaction. You know, I got to tell you, you look at what's going on with the Supreme Court, and it reminds me, it takes me back to the Lochner stuff, to the Lochner era, where the Supreme Court shot down as unconstitutional all minimum wage, all maximum hour laws, all worker issues in favor of big business. And this Supreme Court, I'm telling you, bought and paid for. The best court money can buy. Amazing stuff.
We talked about some of the right-wingers and some of their proposals, and early on we talked about Social Security. Well, Paul Ryan, who's not very shy about proposing private accounts, has come up with his own plan for Social Security reform. Stephen Goss, who's the chief actuary of the Social Security Administration, commented on Paul Ryan's plan. This is what he wrote in the Washington Post. He said his plan, being Paul Ryan's plan, would reduce benefits by raising the retirement age above 65 and reduce benefits for the top 70% of earners. Together, the two provisions would slice or take away a quarter of the income of those on Social Security for Americans who turn 65 in the year 2050. According to the analysis, as a result of Representative Ryan's proposal to change the inflation index, his proposals increasing retirement age would reduce benefits by another 8%. Social Security Administration report shows that overall he would reduce benefits by between, this is unbelievable, between 10 and 50%. 10 to 50% for people we're going out 30, 40 years. That is scary, but this is what the long-term damage and result would be if we allow these people to win. You know, God help us if they do. Another disturbing report. Pharmaceutical industry's agenda. Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, FRAMA, Pharma, continues to lobby against calls to allow Medicare to renegotiate drug prices for seniors. According to analysts at Avalar Health, average premiums under Medicare D will jump by 9.5% in the year 2011 if Medicare does not negotiate them. This is largely due to cost spikes expected if drug prices are left to the open market. The debate over Part D is turning into a key policy issue in areas such as Kentucky, where the Attorney General and U.S. Senator Kennedy Jack Connelly, who, by the way, lost, had made Medicare a central message in his campaign. Conway has stated that empowering Medicare to renegotiate drug prices would save taxpayers billions of dollars, and unfortunately, even though he lost, he is right on. Right on.
How old is that story?
I don't know. It's, I got it off the wire today.
Yeah. I mean, because Conway's, he's history.
I know that. I know that.
I don't know who would even reference him.
Well, that doesn't mean that his policies weren't the right way to go.
Conway was another Democrat who was just a horrible candidate.
He didn't run a good campaign, but he was certainly the better choice.
All right. Yeah, well, I mean, you got Aqua Buddha.
You got Aqua Buddha?
Yeah, I would like it.
The man who thinks that employers should decide whether you have a union or not.
But that's always been the view of the Republican Party. I mean, you should know that already. Which is why, you know, labor gets this bad rap for supporting Democrats. What choice do they have? You know, how could they possibly support someone like Rand Paul?
Well, you couldn't.
You can't. And it's what's amazing to me is I know a bunch of people, a bunch of my friends who are union members who, you know, they vote on single issues, not tied to their wallet, not tied to their paycheck. And, you know, they look what it's gotten us. The Republicans have been brilliant. They really have.
Well, Kentucky is comparatively a conservative state and has traditionally voted for the most part Republican. Every now and then you'll get a Democrat. I think a Democrat ran for governor, a couple years ago.
I think they have a Democratic governor.
They do. He won about 2 years ago.
And they got the first openly gay mayor of one of their big cities. So, I mean, they're not.
Well, Kentucky's a little bit like outside of Louisville.
I think it was Lexington where he's the
mayor. Lexington, the capital. It's a little bit like Pennsylvania. Perhaps it's, Alabama in between. But, you're right about, I'm sure, just like in Pennsylvania, there's a lot of Kentuckians that vote against their own self-interest because of the gun issue. Gee, I mean, that's the way it is. Always has been.
Yeah, it's amazing, and I got to be honest. I spend most of my time thinking about how I'm going to support my family. There are a lot of issues that I'm interested in, but for the most part, it's economic. I vote on economic issues. If you're someone who's against gay marriage, don't marry someone of the same sex. Pretty simple to me. If you're not in favor of abortion, hey, don't have one. Pretty simple stuff. There's a libertarian streak in me that says, all I really care about are pocketbook issues, because I do understand that if you allow corporations to run unfettered, you allow them to run rampant over your economy, they are going to take over. And I fear we're almost there. Honestly, I do believe we're there. I believe they're too powerful now. But I think there's still a chance to rein that in.
I hope so. But if I can comment on the gun issue, I mean, the gun lobby and the Republicans have been very good in scaring you and believing that anybody that wants even marginally reasonable, gun laws are somehow, they paint this picture that, well, you're not going to be able to defend your family, and they're going to come in and they're going to rape your wife and they're going to rob you and perhaps kill your family. But if you really think about logic, let's just say theoretically, and I actually thought this through. Now think about it. I don't think you should never say never in politics, but I do believe they will never pass a bill which outlaw guns. It just won't happen.
No,
our society is just too enamored with guns, and that's just our culture, the way it is. Whatever your position on guns, the fact is, we're always going to have guns. But let's say that they somehow magically pass a law tomorrow in Congress which says they outlaw guns. Okay. You know how fast the federal government works. Be 6 months until they have enough agents. Not only would it take 6 months to train them.
How long?
How many? Okay, I'm being generous. My point is you would need hundreds and hundreds of thousands of agents. And then the truth is, the average gun owner would just hide their guns. You ain't going to confiscate your guns, and it will never, ever, ever, ever happen in this country. But yet there's this innate fear that becomes their number one issue. Well, I've heard people say it that I work with. Well, but that's my number one issue, gun issue. And when you think about the logic, it doesn't make sense. But yet, from their perspective, I understand where they're coming from. They're totally wrong. But yet, the Republicans and the gun lobby and the way they wordsmith it, they've been very effective in driving that wedge between working people and using that vote to improve their quality of life.
There you go. The Jake has spoken.
There you go.
I want to thank everybody for listening tonight. I want to thank Brett, our chief engineer, chief cook and bottle washer over there, working with the tubes and the knobs.
You'll
see you tomorrow night.
To the Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@therickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at therickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USP.
Show.